Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury inviting you to come and see why J.D. Power & Associates rated Lincoln Mercury top on your list. With extensive...
What's so civil about war anyway?
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's Phone and Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome. Welcome to the broadcast. Joining me, of course, as usual, Jolene Jordan. Hi, Jolene.
Hello, Peter.
You know, maybe either we got to win some recent awards or change that introduction. I think it was a long time ago. You ever see these wines? It's on the bottle of wine and the bottle of olive oil. It'll say it won in 1898. I'm thinking, what the hell have they been doing for the last 120 years or whatever?
Well, no, every year we
win the Democratic Media Award. That's right.
We are still award-winning.
I was thinking of the Metro Times Award. You know what I never understand?
Right.
You know who always wins Best Talk Show in Detroit?
No.
The Metro Times Readers Award? It doesn't make any sense to me. Although, I love them. Drew and Mike's show.
Oh!
But they're not a talk show.
Well...
They're a morning show.
It is considered talk in a sense of they don't play music.
I know.
Right.
But don't you think that they ought to have a... Never mind. The hell
they need to have a political talk category.
The hell with all this. Hi.
Okay.
Peter Werby, Jolene Jordan.
We have Kwame to talk about. Yeah,
this is the Night Call Show. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. For the timid... Pardon me. And when the lines are filled, you can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com and short messages. If you want them, if you want me to read them like tomorrow, you can write long. But if you want any chance of getting them on the air read, make them short. Now, Jolene just mentioned Kwame, and I was thinking of more posing it like this. Who needs, and I shouldn't say this because these are my union brothers and sisters, but who needs the writers when we've got reality TV, both the primary elections, and as you said, Kwame, which has great meaning to probably everyone listening in the Detroit metropolitan area.
Right, that's our mayor.
But no meaning whatsoever to anybody outside of the area. Well, actually, it's been news all over.
This is national. It was like a big story on AP and Yahoo.
Yeah. Now, Kwame Kilpatrick, who is the son of Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick, a congressional representative from the Detroit area, was one of the youngest mayors ever, I think, in Detroit history. I think he was like 31 when he became mayor.
Yeah.
And he's had a checkered career. Of course, things as they are, the city's spiraling downward economically. The downtown jewel is glittering, but still, tough times in the Motor City. It's not even the Motor City anymore. I wrote an article years ago called Welcome to the Pizza City, because all these owners of these pizza chains like Domino's and Little Caesars the Motor City. I mean, what percentage of the world's cars are made here in Detroit? Very, very small now. And with the Tata, remember the Tata Nano?
Oh, yeah, that is from, was it India?
Indian
car, vehicle.
Yeah, $2,500. Let's get about $1 billion of them on the road.
Not good.
It's all over for
us. Not good.
Okay, maybe I could just, for those of you who aren't familiar with us, listening like around the world on WRIF.com or radiopower.org, prosecutor launched an investigation Friday, that's this last Friday, into allegations that Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick lied under oath, that's the big thing, about an affair with his top aide, some political blah, 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 whether he should stay. Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy said Friday her office would investigate reports that Kilpatrick and Chief of Staff Christine Beatty exchanged romantic text messages that they testified in a trial last summer that they did not have a physical relationship in 2000 and 2003. So what's at stake here is a direct contradiction to what they swore to under oath, which could send them instead of doing the hokey pokey, they're going to be, or just doing the pokey, they're going to be in the pokey.
That's right.
Yeah. She gives new meaning to the phrase chief of staff.
I should say so.
Well, they could bring up to 15 years imprisonment. And the Detroit Free Press, and that's, by the way, we can always tell whether you're from Detroit or not. Sometimes we have people reading spots that aren't from Michigan. Bad, very bad.
Right.
Advertisers always use local talent. But we say it, the Detroit Free Press, as opposed to most people would say the Detroit Free Press.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's wrong.
And that's not interesting. Okay.
So these, yeah, you know, I was kind of, I was under a bit of a rock for a couple of days last week, and finally got kind of back into, and I see this text. What's with the text messaging?
Text messaging. He sent out how many?
Like 14,000.
14,000 text messages. How can he send out? Now, you're a big texter, right?
I am.
How many do you think you send out? 14?
Well, currently, let's see. For example, I have 168 that I've sent, and that's probably in a month.
Yeah, so how could he do that? How could he send out 14?
He has busy fingers.
I guess so.
Sorry.
Kilpatrick, 37, and Christine Beatty, they've been friends since they went to Cass Technical High School. They're both married at the time to either other people. Right. They exchanged sexual banter, declared their love, and arranged trysts in motels in Metro Detroit and on out-of-town business trips. Well, I mean, this is all just grist for the mill, and we all love this. But
can
the
you explain
the
grist for the mill?
Grist for the tryst. Grist for the mill. I think, I don't know what the hell grist is, but the mill would be a grinding mill. What is grist?
Grist sounds like some kind of the part of the meat that's...
Gristle.
Yeah,
no.
Right.
Okay, somebody Google it. What's grist? What is grist? Now, well, I mean, the fraud of it all, and that's... I mean, I caught about 2 seconds of Brothers and Sisters. It's this TV drama, kind of a soap opera.
Oh, yeah. I think
family.
Sally Field's on that.
Yeah, yeah. And
I haven't seen it.
This woman who's like hanging with a Republican candidate, he's saying tonight, everybody hates politicians. Everyone you know, thinks they're all rotten and corrupt. Well, Kwame Kilpatrick, mayor of Detroit, has certainly added to that characterization. Although it says here in this Detroit News, that's another Detroit daily here, folks, for those of you out of town and out of the country. Kilpatrick, who has characterized himself as a strong family man. You know, as soon as they do that, you know...
They're lying.
Here's what I understand. How could they be that dumb? I mean, how could Clinton have been that dumb?
Oh, for real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I've said this on the air before. If some intern came on to me, the first thing I would think was, and this was wrong, of course, she's a Republican plant.
You right? would?
Yeah. The second thing
okay,
I think...
Okay, that's one of the funniest things you've ever said.
Really?
Yes.
The second thing I would think is, I'm never going to get away with this.
Right.
And I can't remember the third thing. But maybe it is just this arrogance of power that comes to everyone. You know, it's the old thing about power corrupts absolute, power corrupts absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know...
So, you know, it's but it's the lying under oath part. Bothers me. You want to have an affair. People do it every day. I know people who are having affairs as we speak, you know?
Really?
Well, sure. Everywhere.
You think they're listening to the broadcast?
I hope not.
You know, once I had L. Brooks Patterson, who was, what was he then? I think he was the prosecutor of Oakland County. He was before he was the...
commissioner.
He was a commissioner, too, but... He was on this big campaign against pornography. This was like in the 80s.
Really?
Right? So he, I invited him to come on the broadcast to, you know, give him my essentially libertarian view of pornography as long as it's consenting adult. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
No one, you know, no kids, anything like that.
Sure.
So he brought these magazines. You know, they always have these.
He has them?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-mm. So he says, what do you think about things like this? And he shows me. And it was nothing weird or anything. It was just two people having, I guess you can, I'm
doing
you know,
it.
I can, you know, this is late at night and I guess you can say it, but we're having mutual oral sex.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
And so, it seemed pretty like mutual and they look like adults. So, but the deal was, I said, you know, Brooks, there's probably people that at this point are doing that right now in Oakland County.
Everywhere.
Yes, as we speak. And he kind of laughed. I said, why do you laugh? Under the laws of the state of Michigan at the time, this is a crime.
Oh, that's... He was, unbelievable.
Yeah, all right. So, but the deal was, when Kwame Kilpatrick in the city of Detroit was sued by these two officers who said that they were unfairly punished because the two of them had looked into all these parties.
It was a scandal with the stripper.
Yeah, the strippers and all that. I mean, yeah, it's not even worth going. But so the jury awarded the two cops $8 million and another million in legal fees. So Detroit's broke, and because of the misfeasance, the malfeasance of this mayor, the city's out another $9 million. In the meantime, here is Kwame Kilpatrick. In fact, Christine Beatty, the chief of staff, denied an affair 10 times on the witness stand. And here's Kilpatrick is writing, I'm madly in love with you. And what does she write back?
She wrote, I hope you feel that way for a long time. In case you haven't noticed, I'm madly in love with you, too.
They're morons.
But how about this one? I've been dreaming all day about having you all to myself for 3 days, relaxing, laughing, talking, sleeping, and making love.
She is his aide. I mean, don't they see each other?
Chief of staff.
Right. And it'll be on and on and on. But at one point,
I feel sorry for his wife. I just have to. I really have to say that at this point.
There is one. I just saw that. Maybe I lost it. I can't find it. But let me see, is it at the end here? Okay, also, it's come out today in the Detroit Free Press that he used city funds to cover personal travel expenses with his chief of staff, Christine Beatty, as they rendezvoused across the United States during their affair. So they're spending Detroit money. I mean, it's just such corruption.
It really is.
It is. So, gay. Out of here. Well, a number I told someone I knew in another state. And he said, well, how do they have their text messages? And I said, well, they had them on record. He said, they had them on record. He went into a panic.
Mental note, everyone.
But here, it is very, very unusual. Did you get that email? It says most text messages are saved only briefly.
Okay.
Because there is this deal. I always wondered what SMS means, but a short message service technology. And it means it holds it for about 72 hours.
I did not read that.
But here, Mayor Kilpatrick is so dumb that he puts all of this in a text message, and he puts it in the only text message service in America that preserves them.
Really? Aw.
So the guy
Tough luck. Tough luck on the whole thing there.
Yeah.
So, I'd be curious on what the people of Detroit, how they're feeling about this.
What? I'm not.
You don't care?
Well,
I know there's a lot bigger fish to fry in the world.
Yeah, how about people of Detroit only? I don't want to hear, saying things. Yeah.
Okay.
There's always a lot of suburbanites just love to be able to hate black Detroit mayors.
Oh, okay. Well, we don't like that.
Maybe it's not true because people didn't hate Mayor Archer, Dennis Archer.
That's true.
Or trying to think, who the hell, you get these mayors for life. I can't even remember who there was. Coleman Young, who the man, they really hated Coleman Young.
Oh, yeah.
And they always called him Coleman,
Instead of the full name?
Yeah, instead of Mayor Young or Young or something like that.
It's kind of rude.
Yeah, it was kind of rude, but whatever. So anyway, the other half of the reality show is this thoroughly repellent primary election.
I can barely even take it anymore.
I know.
I'm at my limit already, Peter.
The New York Times every day has 4 or 5 pages of coverage of what everybody says in both parties. And I have to say, I don't think I've read 1 inch of copy of all that. But Democrat Barack Obama won in South Carolina by a landslide. And the role of Bill Clinton, I kind of fall for that deal that, the 90s were this, this paradisial period where everything was okay. I mean, rather than Bill giving away the store with NAFTA and the Telecommunications Act.
Oh, absolutely. Which he says was his biggest mistake when he was in office.
Really?
Yeah. He spoke to a group of radio programmers and, just different broadcasters a couple of years ago in Minneapolis, and he told them that that was he made a huge mistake and he wished he'd never done it.
Well, it was
like a couple other things.
It was opposed by the majority of Democratic senators, and as was NAFTA. So he signed on to mostly Republican legislation.
Yeah, I always told my Republican father, I go, well, you must love Bill. He's a good Republican.
Yeah, yeah. So now, though, I mean, any sort of sense that he comes off like the elder statesman, the likable, lovable Bill, I mean, he's being awful in this campaign.
He's not helping. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't think he's helping her, helping Hillary. In fact, they're calling it now Billary.
Oh, they are.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that one. That's a good one.
The Economist, and I think this may be edited in London, but you know, the Europeans are all over this presidential race. I mean, they are nuts for it. But here's what the Economist said. The Clintons are in the process of doing the impossible, making the 2008 election a referendum on them rather than on the Republicans.
Oh, my gosh.
In fact, Frank Rich in the New York Times today said that you would think that the Democratic victory would be a slam dunk. Given the disaster that George W. Bush has brought to the country, and instead he said if it winds up to be Hillary versus McCain, which I'm sure most Republican bigwigs and the corporate Republicans are hoping it's McCain, it's really a crapshoot about who's going to win. Whereas I think that we're talking President Obama right now.
I think we are, too. Yeah, I think it's going to come down to McCain and Obama, for sure.
And given what the prejudices, unfortunately. I mean, what I would like that if... I know race is still an issue, but...
A huge issue.
But on the other hand, there is... Barack Obama is not running as a black candidate. In fact, think about racialist, let's put it this way, racialist concept of race. Now, remember the phrase that I've used so much, it's always mama baby, papa maybe.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So given that, and his mother is Euro-American.
That's right.
So why, you know, but it's like black is a negative, so that, you could at least say, Mr. Obama, you can have your choice. You can be a Euro-American or an African-American, right?
Right.
Because you're 50-50.
Yeah.
But I know people, maybe this story's too long. But in any event, it would be nice just one of the reasons I think that particularly younger people have voted for Obama, it's like it doesn't make a difference, and it's a statement.
True.
Now, I'm not a big Obama fan.
Right.
And I don't think that that there's going to be change.
I don't either.
Yeah. It's going
with
to be,
any of them.
Yeah. It's because... You know, it's the same military-industrial complex budget. It's the same political configurations. There's nothing dramatic that's being suggested for health care. In fact, in many ways, Obama has one of the more conservative platforms for health care in this country. I mean, they obviously, now that Dennis Kucinich has dropped out, there's nobody with a fundamental solution to the health care problem in this country, which is like every other country has almost, and that's a universal single-payer health care program.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, we can't afford anything.
That's right.
We're broke.
We are broke.
We're going down.
Beyond broke.
Yeah. Down, yeah. Yeah. Let me see if there's anything else. About. So I don't know if anybody has any... opinions about this Obama thing. Here, you know, another thing I didn't like about it, they have to do this, I guess. This is today. On his first visit to the church to which he now belongs, Obama said, I was introduced to Jesus in a way I've never been before.
Did he really?
Well, they all give this.
Why must they?
They feel like they have to.
Because so they can get that vote.
Yeah. I mean, at one point, like 5 years ago, they did this... this poll, and it said that most people, they would rather their daughters married a Muslim, which was in low regard at the time, and maybe still.
I think it's worse now.
than an atheist.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
What's wrong with atheists?
Not well. What do you mean? You mean I misunderstood.
What do they have against atheists?
I don't know. And was it last week? Yeah, it said that 92% of people in this country are Christians. And I said, do I know all 8%? I don't know that many people.
I think between the two of us, it may be so.
Well, maybe. But in the Constitution, Article 6, Section 3 states, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States.
Yeah, well, that's a bunch of hooey right now.
Yeah.
That's out the window.
So think about this, people. The founding fathers, who everybody said they were Christians, you know, they weren't all. Some were, and a lot of them talked about God, and very few of them talked about Jesus, but they talked about God, but there's no mention of God or, and certainly not of Jesus in the Constitution. And think about the fear they must have had that in two places. One, it says no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification in any office or public trust. And it's weird that they have the word ever in there. You would think it would read no religious test shall be required. But it says no religious test shall ever be required.
Wow.
And yet here you have these political frauds falling over each other trying to show how Jesus is their personal savior.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then the First Amendment to the Constitution, which does not guarantee anything, but says Congress shall make no law establishing a religion. That's how worried the founding fathers were about the intervention of religion into the political world. So,
well, they'd certainly be appalled today, wouldn't they?
So someone says, well, you have a lot of criticisms of Obama, as most of the other candidates. I'd say, yeah. Would you vote for him? I'd say, yeah, because I'll vote for the lesser of two evils. Because
yeah, be holding our noses.
I would rather have the lesser of the two evils than the greater of the
just
two evils.
Just seems to make sense.
And McCain, I mean, he's this guy he's talking about. I wouldn't mind if the U.S. troops were in Iraq for 100 years.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because he says, and this leads us into the economy, he says, for instance, that we've had troops in Korea for over 50 years. Right?
Yeah.
And we also have troops around the world in 750 to 800 bases.
Yes.
Yeah.
And why?
Well, it's a military-industrial complex.
Right.
So in the meantime, what a scary title. And this is from Newsweek. The U.S. economy faces the guillotine.
Oh.
Yeah. America's on the road to recession, and many predict a worldwide slowdown. But it's a new economic order, and the emerging markets could take the lead. I don't know what the hell. I haven't even read this.
You know what? If we weren't anxious before, just reading that headline would create an incredible amount of anxiety, and did when you showed it to me.
Yeah, and I'm sure that, I mean, I always think I'm somebody with a secure job. I mean, been here a long time.
You've been here a long time.
And you know what? I don't feel absolutely secure.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, because of the state of the economy, not necessarily because of your views your broadcasting abilities. Yeah.
Think about this, though. There are stations around, there's a whole chain of them, that have no on-air paid. I hope our bosses are there. They go, really? That's not a bad idea. No, they know all about it.
Yeah.
In fact, the people at this network, the Greater Media, and the stations that they own here and in New Jersey, Philadelphia, mm-hmm. they're committed as a policy and of quality programming to having on-air live DJs, live and local.
That's right. Yeah.
But that there's a number of people figure, well, wait a minute. I can just get somebody in California to send me CDs or whatever. Actually, I think they still send CDs. I don't want to mention.
Yeah, I would say it'd be a computer.
MP3 or something like that. But, okay. And it has your week's music and all these, what they call drops, the stuff between the songs.
Yeah.
And most people, they're listening. It's a jukebox and probably don't even, I bet if you ask people that listen to that station, do you know that these are recorded DJs? I bet a good percentage, if not most of them, would not know.
Absolutely. But they would not know.
But the people that listen to WRIF and the people that listen to the other stations that the Greater Media own in Detroit, they know damn well that it's live.
That we're here.
And it's local.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. But it costs a fortune to have talent.
Yes. And
that's one of the big costs of running a radio station is paying people and paying people good wages.
Yes.
Okay, I'm not saying anything.
You know. Okay.
Listen, I'm not a kiss ass. I love these people.
I do too.
And I don't think any bosses are listening.
No, you don't?
No, do you?
You never know.
How about screw the boss?
Oh, no.
So I wouldn't say no.
He said it.
No, I didn't. I'm thinking of all of them. I love them all.
I do
I've
too.
Never, I mean, I've worked for some of the biggest idiots on the planet. Probably everybody in radio has. And this is, and you know, people are just going to think I'm a kiss ass. But anyway.
No, but it's very true. They're
it is
very
true.
Good
these are a good bunch of people. Yeah. Well, they're not just good to us. They're good people.
Well, it's a good company. And I mean, you hear about that one big company that everyone calls evil that is
I'll call their name.
Okay.
I'll call their name
right.
for a channel. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, the difference between working for them and working for a company like this
right.
is night and day.
You even have a personal story about that, but should we move on?
Let's move on.
Okay.
Moving right along.
All right. Okay. Let's get anxious again. The U.S. economy faces the guillotine, says Newsweek. The great global market freakout of 2008. Weird language. You know, this is modern.
The great global freakout?
Global market freakout.
Oh.
Has everyone asking whether the United States, already on the road to recession, is entering into a protracted period of economic trouble where jobs will be slashed, prices will continue to rise, and the dollar will keep falling. And if so, whether the declining U.S. economy will pull the rest of the world down with it.
Whoa. That is depressing stuff.
See, I don't understand this, to tell you the truth. How weird.
Is that because it's 20 pages long?
Yeah. But, you know, the economy, you know, even the people that say they, you know, they understand it, I'm not really sure that they do. Like, for instance, they're always talking about money being lost.
Right.
But the guy in France lost $7.8 billion.
How do you lose?
Well, that's what I mean. So I wrote in the note here to myself, where do losses go? Now, sometimes they go, you know, they're scammed and they go to other people, like the 1980s savings and loan scandal.
Sure.
They say, we lost. Well, somebody wound up with it. Or does wealth just contract? So what was projected, and see,
And you know my head spinning.
Yeah. So is there, what I'm getting at is that the wealth was just a mirage, an illusion, that it really wasn't there, that it was an, like a lot of these stocks, they go up because there's this anticipated return on investment. But then they realize, oh, it's, I mean, it's like paintings. I mean, some guy in Amsterdam paints some, is that what he paints? And paints some thing, sells it for like, 20 kronig. And then 100 years later, it's selling for literally $123 million.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, what makes this $123 million? I guess it's, you know, it's supply and demand. There's one of it. A lot of people want it. But it's insane. So there's a lot of fictional value. I mean, so things are way overvalued. But I don't know. I can't understand it.
It is very, very, very confusing.
Yeah. Well, at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, minus five GMT. I love that.
Greenwich, I know you do.
Greenwich Mean Time. I am going to be playing an interview I did earlier this week with Chalmers Johnson. Some of you.
Ah.
Yeah, he was in Why We Fight, which was an excellent film, documentary. He says it's virtually, and this is on my site, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. You can see this. I would really advise reading this. It's called Going Bankrupt, Why the Debt Crisis is Now the Greatest Threat to the American Republic. So he's not just talking about the economy, but this country in many ways was modeled on Rome. The founding fathers looked at the Roman Republic, and what comes after the Republic is the empire. Well, we have an empire now, but at least at home we've maintained at least formal democratic forms. Mm-hmm. And but then, so you get Caesar, but then, you know, you wind up with Caligula and Nero, and we may have that now. Except Bush isn't as smart as either of those guys. Anyway, here's what Chalmers Johnson says, and he'll say more of this later on tonight. It's virtually impossible to overstate the profligacy. Remember the profligate son that was, spending too much.
Okay.
That's of what our government spends on the military. The Department of Defense's planned expenditures for fiscal year 2008 are larger than all other nations' military budgets combined.
Oh, my God.
The supplementary budget to pay for the current wars in Iraq and Iran, not part of the official defense budget. Now, we're talking about just what they're paying just for the wars, is itself larger than the combined military budgets of Russia and China.
Ugh.
So we're not talking about the military budget of the United States. We're talking about just what you and I are taking our tax dollars and paying for Bush's lying war, his murderous war that has hurt so many people for no reason whatsoever. And just the cost of that is has cost us more than the combined military budgets of Russia and China. So we're not out there trying to stop Russia and China. They don't represent any military threat now, and to the extent that they have any in the future, it could be reduced through negotiations. Okay? So why do we do that? Well, I won't jump the gun here, but he, Chalmers Johnson, says defense-related spending for fiscal 2008 exceeds $1 trillion for the first time in history. Now, a lot of it is hidden. So you get a, what is it, about six, I forgot what it is, 600 and something billion dollars. And but all this other stuff is hidden throughout the budgets, like the atomic warfare budget is in the defense or in the energy department.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
You know, I mentioned in the interview this book by this conservative historian called Paul Kennedy. It's the name of it, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. And it talks about how all these empires overextended themselves militarily. We're talking Spain and France and Britain, the Netherlands, Portugal. And they went broke trying to administer an empire spread across the world. But it's odd because those empires were like running out of cash during the 15th and 16th century. And they had to find other areas of the world to loot. Because they were broke. Remember that charming little tale about Queen Isabella pawned jewels in order to finance Columbus's journey?
Sure.
And he was looking for spices, slaves, gold.
Right.
They were all so awful.
Horrible.
Man. But what's the interesting part about that is not that it's charming, is that this royal family didn't have any money. So they had to find new sources of wealth and wealth creation. And that was done first by, they hoped, just by looting of gold, but also trade for spices. And then they started this very, very lucrative slave trade.
Right, yeah. You know, Peter, if people weren't frightened a half hour ago, whew.
Yeah, well, let me see. All right, let's take a break, and we got a lot of people waiting.
Yeah.
I haven't even looked to see. Let me just see.
We're pretty loaded up there, Peter.
I'm not even on the screen.
Remember, it is a call-in talk show.
Yeah, that's right. do we have a number here? 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
That was pretty good, Peter.
Welcome. Well, we've got this guy. Everybody in Detroit knows Arthur Pinello, Big Daddy.
He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, baby.
Is he?
Yes, he's one of very few DJs who is.
Yeah. And he sat in this chair. His butt was sitting in this chair. He's held the morning drive, or sorry,
afternoon
drive longer than any DJ in American
the
history.
World.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, in the world. Right.
For real.
And he's got his slogan is...
Baby!
Yeah, I like that.
One of a few.
Yeah. I remember one time we were talking with a consultant at a meeting, and he says, you're lucky you chose that as your kind of signature slogan as opposed to, like, far out. That wouldn't have lasted. All right. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. I was way over my head, of course. I was trying to fake it like I really knew what profligacy means. But we're talking about, and that's what Chalmers Johnson says it's profligate what our government spends on the military. I was close. The dictionary definition is given over to dissipation, dissolute, recklessly wasteful, wildly extravagant. Wildly extravagant. So that's what the military-industrial complex is. And when you read all of the stuff in all the publications, like the New York Times, which is the voice of big finance capital in this country. These are the guys that don't mess around. They've been rich for 100 years, and they want to be rich for another 100 years. And they're fearful that Bushko has just ruined for short-term gain for his his buddies like Halliburton and what have you, has ruined the store because they went out and gambled, should have been buying more stock, and instead.
They may be onto something.
Yeah. Well, deal is, you read all this stuff, you know, beyond the stimulus package and what have you, and they never really get to the nub of it, which is that we have a warfare economy that does not produce out of it what we need. There's no, you know, the only thing we're manufacturing here are weapons. All right, you want to get on the air? You want to talk? 313-298-WRI.
Why not?
Let's see. Okay, boy, we. MD, you're on the line. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello?
MD.
Peter.
Yeah.
I have something to say about the Kwame Kilpatrick scandal here.
But remember, I've kicked your ass off the air any number of times, so.
Well, I know you have. That's why I keep coming back.
Okay.
Anyway, here's the deal. This is so reminiscent of Bill Clinton. Some friends of mine and I were sitting around a few days ago when this whole thing reared its ugly head, I would be willing to bet you $5,000 that Kwame Kilpatrick was on the phone with Bill Clinton to the tune of something like, okay, how do I get out of this?
You never know.
You never know.
You know he's got people that are working on it.
Yeah.
Damage control.
Yeah. And maybe Bill called Kwame and said, hey, endorse.
Let me give you some help.
Of course, endorsing Hillary wouldn't do Hillary any good, would you?
No.
You did real well. Yeah, no, he is from time to time. Actually, I love MD. MD stands for Mad Dog.
Oh, I remember Matt. He's been calling for years.
Goes way back.
Way back.
All right. Some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF.
Did he try to come in incognito?
No, he was okay. He seemed calm.
Pseudoname?
He one time said that he drives better drunk than he does sober.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Let me see. Here is someone called in and said, someone wants to know if you could give some websites that give the lowdown on the candidates for the uninformed voter. Nope.
The few that we could send them to, though, that they could get some good information would be commondreams.org.
Yeah, well, that's all
because
on one side.
But there's going to be all...
Yeah. Actually, in terms of foreign policy, where they list... I just found something on there. All the foreign policy platforms of the candidates. None of it, again, looks too pretty. All right, let's take another call. Here's John in Rochester Hills. Hi, John. It's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Doing good.
Hey, man. My whole issue is with the Democratic Party is how they can just go back and forth with each other.
What do you mean?
Oh, well, with the Republicans?
Debating, no, no, between the Democrats.
Mm, oh, yeah.
As far as, you know, who voted for what, when they voted for it, and not stick to the issues.
I know. You know, it's not very pretty, is it? In fact, you would almost think that at a point, in fact, that's what I was saying earlier, when there is, it's almost like what should have been a slam dunk for the Democrats. The people are going to find it all, the whole process, so distasteful. I do, don't you?
I mean, it's like listening to kindergartens. It literally is.
It's true.
Yeah, it is. It's real bad.
But yet they're our only option. I mean, and another thing that flips me out is that the the Republicans get reelected. I mean, and they get real, and the stuff that they get reelected on is what blows my mind. As far as, like, you know, gay marriage was 2004.
Sure.
Instead of, you know, the Democrats. I mean, how could they lose that, man? It blows my mind.
Well, they've never been a very effective political party, except in a certain period, certainly during, and that was, what, 70 years ago, 75 years ago, during the Roosevelt administration, other periods. But now, they're like, for instance, on this whole thing with the tax rebate, they let Bush, who is this roundly despised president, who people know uniformly, all Democrats and most Republicans now even think that he's been a failure, certainly on the war issues and for sure on the economy. And yet he says, well, we're going to give $50 billion in tax breaks to businesses. I mean, what the hell is that all about? And we're not going to give any to seniors. We're not going to give any to retirees. We're not going to give any to the poorest people. And instead, a lot of this money is going to go to people that that don't need it. You know what? And sometimes this makes, I mean, I never mean to brag, but I don't really need that tax rebate.
Right.
But, you know, there are people, and Julian and I now live fairly close to each other. All of a sudden, you're starting to see these for sale signs pop up.
Oh, today. I said it just today. I couldn't believe it. More and more.
Yeah. And what's at issue here is people like that would immediately start pay off like what they're behind on their mortgage payments. And instead, I'll probably plunk it in the bank.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Or something like that. And that's not what you want to do with it. And anyways, where the hell are they getting $150 billion for? We're already a debtor nation. It's like somebody who's maxed out on their credit card and somehow managed to scam another card. You know, or maybe they'll, one of two things, they'll just have the bank print more money, and it's driving the value of the dollar down ever more, or they'll just go to their, you know, go to the bank, go to the loan shark. Yeah, go to the loan shark, say, hey, we need $150 billion, or the whole S house is going to go down the drain.
I have a question. Is he still?
Yeah, John's here.
John, is there anyone that you're leaning toward?
Yeah, I like Hillary Clinton. I like Bill Clinton a whole lot.
Even with all this stuff going on, you don't find it quite as disturbing? I mean, they seem to be the focus of starting the S fights. That's twice.
All right, well, let me ask you this. Who started it? Because before Hillary, when they first started debating, Hillary never brought up Obama or Edwards. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, they both attacked her, and now they're getting beat up a little bit. Now it's a bad thing.
You know what? I'll tell you what, John. I withdraw my statement, and I'm keeping out of it.
They're all a pack of psychos.
Yeah, well, God. All right, John. Thank you very much. You know, I don't even think there's... I mean,
you don't?
No. I think the Republicans...
Don't you have to be a little bit psychotic?
To want to do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't... I mean, I don't think Dennis Kucinich is Mike Gravel or let's go to the bottom or
we should call it the top
or Ron Paul. Yeah. It's just disgusting, though, that people with real platforms that address. In fact, you know, the reason that nobody was very horrified about either Ron Paul's. I was playing handball at this club in Warren, and I looked at someone had a Ron Paul like card with all its platform. I go, oh, my God. You know, it says number one. Out of Iraq now.
Okay.
I mean, that does not sound like a right winger.
No.
And it's a repeal NAFTA and the other trade agreement, WTO. And we just went down the line. Protect our civil liberties. Da-da-da-da, like that. Withdraw all the bases from around the world.
Well, where did it go bad?
Well, he didn't have billions of dollars. The corporations, which...
did it ever say any...
No, it never got anything that you would have to give up.
Right. I would have to give up. Right, right, exactly.
Okay, let's get some people on here that are kind of out of our areas because they're hanging on. John in Toledo. John, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for calling. Yeah, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Hey, I'll make this as brief as I can. I'm an engineer, right? And I spent a lot of time traveling overseas, about 90% of the time for 5 years. And so I got to see the other side. And I didn't live with the rich. I lived with the poor. Bottom line is there's roughly a 50% import tax on anything that we import into another country, but we let them flood our market with free goods, no import tariffs basically whatsoever. And we're the largest consuming nation in the world. As an engineer, to solve a problem, the first thing you have to concisely identify the problem. We have a problem with the economy. Agree?
Right. Sure.
Okay. We're not going to change the government. Agree?
Well,
okay. Yeah.
Let's keep trying.
Though, right? Okay.
Yeah.
The big money corporations are really pulling the rabbits out of the hat and pulling the strings and making these things happen. We're not going to change that either, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
He's going so fast.
I'm sorry because I'm on the air and I figured that I don't have much
time. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Relax. Take a breath.
I'm sorry. Like, I went to India and Thailand and all these places. We're competing against labor that's like 10 cents an hour in Thailand. I mean, 50 cents an hour in Thailand, 10 cents an hour in India. A degree engineer, for me to have him on my staff, was $1 an hour in India, right?
Wow.
You can't win a fight like that. You win by not playing. It's very simple. If Americans buy American goods, the big money corporations that are pulling the strings get the screws put to them on their wallet, and then they have to change the policies.
Well, here is the problem. I mean, as you may know, tariffs, which means that taxes incoming goods, paid for about 90% of the government up till the American Civil War. After that, it paid for a great part of it up to World War One and even after World War One. But as the country becomes deindustrialized, we aren't making very much. So it's the deal would have been when we were making shoes here, when we were a great shoemaking nation, that other shoes that came in, had tariffs that either made them equal or, in fact, they were protective tariffs that made foreign shoes more expensive. And the only time people would buy shoes from another country is when they were high style, like Italian shoes or something like that. But as the country becomes deindustrialized and we make no more shoes in this country and no more jeans in this country and, less cars and everything like that, if we put a tariff on them, I mean, it would just actually be costing the American people more and more money and would cause inflation. You know, this is not a simple problem.
I agree. I completely agree with you. And that was the point that I was trying to make, was that all of these rules are slanted against us in a lot of different ways. And we've got a big problem that we have to start doing something to change. And if people would just very simply buy American. When I was in Korea, if you walked into a Korean store, if it wasn't made in Korea, you couldn't buy it there. And they went from eating grass and tree bark a few decades ago to being what Japan used to be now.
Yeah, that's
because they only buy their own goods. And that way the people that have the big money that are making the decisions for the poor man that don't even live in the same realm, they get the screws put to them because the goods are rotting on the shelves. I realize there's not as much to pick from, and there's an effort that has to be gone through to make the transition. But it's a solution to the problem. All the candidates, everything else I've seen, they just want to give more of the same. We're drowning in debt.
Yeah, we are indeed. And it's what I said, too. If you're going to have a federal budget that spends $1 trillion a year on the military-industrial complex, none of the solutions are going to work. I mean, that if we cut 75% of the military budget, reduced it by 75%, do what a Republican says and bring back all of the 750 bases around the world. We don't need any of them. What the hell do we have bases in other countries for? And then that leaves us with hundreds of billions of dollars a year that, first and foremost, as I always advocate, a $50,000 tax deduction right off the top. So if you're making $52,000 a year, you pay tax on $2,000. You make the upper levels a lot steeper like it used to be. And there's a lot of money to do a lot of things that'll generate it within the economy. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thanks for calling in from Ohio. Let's go to St. Paul, Minnesota, and talk to Tom. Tom, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Oh, I'm glad to talk to sanity out in the world. There's very few places I can call and get somebody
good
that has a brain on the other end of the line.
Well, thank you.
I just wish you were on more often. Although I listen to Tom Hartman, and that helps.
He's our buddy. Yeah, he's good.
Let me say next week, by the way, let me, just one second, that Jolene is going to be doing the show. I'm taking the Sunday off, so it'll be Jolene. Just me. Yeah. Go ahead, Tom. You're on the air.
Okay, well.
But she's a voice of sanity, too.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah, things have rubbed off. She's a voice of sanity. I sent you an email, but if we have a $150 billion economic stimulus and we have 300 million people in the country, that's $500 per person. Now, why wouldn't a family of four get $2,000 instead of between $6 and $1,200?
I don't know. You know? This is all...
There doesn't seem much of a method to the madness.
Or instead of doing all this paperwork and cutting all these checks, why not give 50 checks to states per population? Say, Michigan has a population of 10 million. That would be $5 billion, which is more than 10% of the entire state budget of Michigan.
Wow.
They give one check of $5 billion to Michigan, and then you people can decide for yourselves what's a sensible way. Let's stop buying all this crap from Walmart and pizza with this money and buy something useful like maybe health care for everybody and massive commodity distribution.
There's got to be a strategy to get us as a nation out of debt. Because as we stand now, if you're like 25 years old, if things keep going as they are, if you're a 25-year-old, your grandchildren are still going to be paying off the debt that George W. Bush ran up. And, I mean, he's just the end of this whole process that began like 50 years ago or more that created this military-industrial complex that has been part of what has destroyed the American economy and wound up that it's only its motor force has become preparation for war with no enemies. How the hell can they keep this illusion going?
You're not going to get any argument out of me.
All right. Tom, thanks for calling in from Minnesota.
I
appreciate it. Hey, let me ask you a question. How's the Al Franken for Senate candidacy going there? Does that look real?
Well, I think Al Franken's good friends with Hillary Clinton. I mean, there's three people in the race, a wealthy lawyer, Al Franken, and then this other person that's off the same vine as Paul Wellstone, who's talking real sensible. But Al Franken, he's not going to enjoy being a senator. He's a central Democratic Party.
He's a centrist.
He was supporting the war.
Yeah, he was at first. Yeah, he was on Air America. Was there the same time I worked?
And he's such an easy target, you know? I mean, just go back 20 years and pull some clips from Saturday Night Live and say, let's see, what would the Republicans do with this? You know, and Norm Coleman is such a suit and a vote for Bush that...
the senator from Minnesota, that's up for re-election. Yeah.
So we got to get rid of him, and I think Al Franken is just going to get crushed.
Really? What do the polls show in terms of the Democratic primary in Minnesota for?
Well, I think they're putting Franken ahead. They're probably, but there's the polls are saying that Coleman still has like 52% approval rating.
Really?
I don't know.
Amazing.
I'm just looking at the bottom line, like you got to look for real answers, and I think Franken is just he's going to be beat up for his. He's a comedian.
There was a professional wrestler, which is...
Yeah, you guys got a bad history.
Well, the problem is that Jesse was getting beat up all the time, and you got to have a big ego to be in that business, and so he worried about his ego too much.
Think about this.
And
Arnold.
He fell for it.
What about Arnold?
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
what about who?
Arnold.
Schwarzenegger. And think about Ronald Reagan.
I had a friend say that no one who's an actor should be able to go run for public office. And
well,
I said, no actor that does a movie with a monkey should be able to run.
Tom, thanks for your call. I appreciate it.
Please.
Thanks for calling in. Let's see here. It's Alan Inkster. Al, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air with us.
Hey, Pete. Hi, Jolene.
Hi, Al.
Hey, text me, babe.
Text it. I love you, Al.
I'm calling up to say if anybody else spotted Barack Obama's plagiarism on his victory speech last night.
What did he say? I have a dream, or
no, he kept,
ask not what.
Oh no!
About inclusion and ending cynicism and bringing everybody in, no matter how far down in the, you know, how far down oppressed they are.
No.
And then he ended up chanting, "Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Yes, we can." And then the audience picked it up. Yes, we can.
Remind us.
Wasn't that a Bush one?
Cesar Chavez.
Oh.
The slogan was "Yes, we can," which in Spanish was "Si se puede."
Oh yeah. By the way, folks, this is no relation to Hugo. This is the farm worker.
Right.
The great dude.
Yeah, the great dude. He was good. Well, you never can tell. You know that. But imitation is the greatest form of flattery.
And it's true.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Al. Something went in and out of my brain, so I'll try to remember it when we come back. Peter Werbe, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And call talkyes at yahoo.com.
This is WRIF.com.
On WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
All right, thank you very much. And joined by Jalene Jordan. Jalene will be doing the show by yourself next week. I'm going to take the week off. A little
surprise. It's going to be lonely without you, Peter.
I'll have a little surprise when I come back. All that plastic. No.
Right. You're in radio, remember?
Yeah, finally taking care of that nose.
Yeah, right.
You know, remember when there was this big discussion about waterboarding and it was pretty clear that it was torture, and suddenly out of nowhere, the CIA. CIA guy pops up, said he supervised the waterboarding of these two Al-Qaeda guys who confessed everything under the sun. You know, they and he said he thinks that it is torture, but that it worked because after torturing these guys for like 38 seconds, wasn't that it, or something like that, they confessed to everything. Of course, they had hundreds of hours of tapes. What the hell? Why they destroyed those?
Where did those go? Right.
Yeah, and remember the thing was too, they didn't want the identity of the CIA agents known because they might have experienced retaliation. So why did this guy come out and say that it was him and he was on every television program? So you sort of wondered about it. I mean, for one thing, you didn't know any of the truth of any of it because it was beyond legal. It was extra legal. It was outside the legal process, is why they have things like habeas corpus, why they have rules and laws and constitutions and what have you, something that the Bush crime family, to use the phrase of another one of our talk show colleagues, uses all the time. Well, now it turns out that according to this show on 60 Minutes with Scott Pelley, Saddam Hussein initially didn't think the U.S. would invade Iraq to destroy weapons of mass destruction, so he kept the fact that he had none a secret to prevent an Iranian invasion he believed could happen. The Iraqi dictator revealed this thinking to George Pyro, the FBI agent assigned to interrogate him after his capture. Once the invasion was certain, says Pyro, Saddam asked his generals if they could hold the invaders for 2 weeks, and well, they couldn't. He said Saddam still wouldn't admit he had no weapons of mass destruction, even when it was obvious there would be military action against him because of the perception that he did. Because, says Pyro, for him, it was critical that he be seen as still strong, defiant Saddam. He thought that faking having the weapons would prevent the Iranians from reinvading Iraq. Now, so what's the underlying story here? The underlying story is that Bush and the rest of them essentially are fairly innocent of all this because
excuse me.
This is the story. I'm not saying he was.
Okay, just checking.
This is another load of crap because now how did I know? And how did you know? And how did a great numbers of people in our audience know there were no weapons of mass destruction? Actually, the information was out there. And if I knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, do they really think Iran thought that he did?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so this is a load of crap.
And we knew that Bush was planning on going in there, you know.
Regardless.
No matter what.
Yeah, because they were finding out, as the people may remember, in March of 2003, we're going on five-year war, folks. That the United Nations inspectors were in there, all that Saddam was cooperating. They were looking at everywhere and everything, and they found absolutely nothing. Remember, you know, and Powell, the Secretary of State Powell, pretty much admitted that they weren't finding anything, even though he'd said all this stuff. And Cheney said they knew exactly where all this poison gas was. Well, there wasn't any. They didn't know anything, and they didn't find anything because there was nothing there.
Well, and the sheeple believed, anyone who, you know, out of the White House who spoke about that.
Right. Now, it comes out, and this was a lead story on Yahoo News. False statements preceded war. A study by two nonprofit journalism organizations found that President Bush and top administration officials issued hundreds of false statements about the national security threat from Iraq in the 2 years following the 2001 terrorist attacks. Now, again, I knew that. Jolene knew that. We would broadcast that on our national daily syndicated show.
We didn't need the study to tell us this.
And we lost affiliates. People said, you're saying the President of the United States is a liar.
Boom. We did say it. And they were dropping like flies, our affiliates.
Now the study,
and we were the voice of sanity.
Exactly. As Tom from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Frustrating.
Said. Yeah. The study concluded that the statements, pardon me, were part of an orchestrated campaign that effectively galvanized public opinion and in the process led the nation to war under decidedly false pretenses. Exactly what we said. This is the website. You have that there?
It's from the Center for Public
Integrity. Go on, read it for a while I call.
Integrity. Okay, all right. Well, it's the website of the Center for Public Integrity. And we've talked about this organization for a long time, actually. And there is a whole website that assembles, so to speak, that's the headline, assembles U.S. pre-war claims. So, and this is really interesting. If it's from the New York Times, the 23rd, so it would have been Wednesday. They have a brand. I think if you just go to Center, Google Center for Public Integrity, and that will send you to the new website.
Yeah.
That it says allows simple searches for specific phrases. And let's see.
Well, this is kind of like Kwame Kilpatrick made 14,000
right.
text messages. Not that bad. But the study concluded that there were 935 false statements in the two-year period.
Right. And they link the entire, all of the claims. They connect the dots. Remember when we always used to say
yeah.
that?
Yeah. You know, in fact, we used to begin our program. It said the only program that dares to
connect the dots.
No, everybody does. All of you do. So yeah. we dropped that. Named in the study along with Bush were top officials of the administration during the period. Remember, it's almost like Monica Lewinsky. They're so out of public view. Vice President Dick Cheney, remember him?
You know, I was at breakfast today, and I said that same exact thing. I go, Dick Cheney, where'd he go? Oh, Osama bin
Forgotten. Yeah, Condi Rice still around, but Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Man, remember they were saying he's such a sex symbol?
Yuck.
Secretary of State Colin Powell disgraced himself by his lying speech in the United Nations. I'm not reading this. This is my I'm saying. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, who is was one of the architects of this war, who sold it to not only that there was all these threats from Iraq, but also that it would be an easy war to win. Now, Paul Wolfowitz went on to head the World Bank. I mean, it's true with all these crime families, and the Bush crime family goes back into the 1980s, of course, when Papa Bush was the vice president and then the president, and he had all these people that were involved in all this criminal activity, some of whom got convicted, but wound up just back in the Bush administration, including Elliot Abrams, who went with Bush over to Saudi Arabia, who was laying around this tent with all this bling bling on. You know, they gave him all this bling, and they had these robes on, and they're laying in this this
Isn't
tent with
sweet?
This shake. Yeah, probably while they're amputating somebody's hand and lashing somebody. They all and but now Paul Wolfowitz has just been named to head some commission. A commission about security.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
He's back.
He's back.
Hey, Peter, I found the website. It's publicintegrity.org, so you know, to connect the dots.
Now, the center says the cumulative effect of these false statements, all 935 of them, amplified by thousands of news stories and broadcasts, was massive, with the media coverage creating an almost impenetrable din for several critical months in the run-up to the war. Some journalists, indeed, some entire news organizations have since acknowledged that their coverage during these pre-war months was too deferential and uncritical. These mea culpas, I'm guilty. Notwithstanding, much of the wall-to-wall media coverage provided additional independent validation of the Bush administration's false statements about Iraq. So what do we learn from this? Well, when President Obama says that we are going to war with Venezuela, or President Clinton, the new one, says, or when President McCain says, remember all this. Don't be fooled again. Just hear, even some of you who don't even like classic rock, just keep hearing those sounds of the Who, won't get fooled again. So you're not fooled again. So you're not complicit in one of these slaughters that winds up be a justification for the military-industrial complex that's stealing our money that we've earned and your parents' money, and is going to be stealing your children's money and your grandchildren's money. Now, one thing, since I think I just sent you this from the New York Times on January 23rd, this was the lead story in Yahoo News. False statements preceded war, and with this photograph of Bush. Now, if I had a newspaper, I would have as the headline, Bush lied, tens of thousands died.
Oh, absolutely. And that's also a bumper sticker that I had on my car for a long time. Bush lied, people died.
Yeah. Now, what though the New York Times, all right. Okay. I got the message. Thank you. Yeah. What, don't we have like a modern way to communicate rather than... All right.
It's pretty modern in here.
Right. The New York Times, the paper of record, one of the media outlets responsible for reporting this these misstatements about the war was the New York Times. Here's what you read the headline, Julian, correctly, but it was on page 12 at the bottom of the page, and the headline was "Website Assembles U.S. Pre-War Claims." That's not a
Right.
Yeah, that that varies.
It's not very sexy either.
I didn't know this was going to happen, but this is what a treat. Here's our old friend Nancy Skinner. Hi, Nancy Skinner. Hey, are you with us? She just left. I mean, maybe she got stage fright.
No.
Now, Nancy Skinner, we should give full disclosure here, is a former colleague of ours and a friend. She, when we were doing the network syndicated show, Jalene and I, from 2000 to 2003, Nancy was doing mornings on the network, and she's probably ringing back right here.
She
ran for the senatorial nomination in 2004 against Barack Obama in Illinois. She's a Detroiter. Why don't you put her on hold or something like that? It's probably her. See that bottom line ring? And let's see what else. And she also ran. She also ran against Republican Representative Joe Nolenberg in the Congressional 9th District in 2006 and came damn close. Didn't get a lot of money. She I think, raised about $600,000. Imagine that being nowhere near enough money.
Yeah, really.
Joe Nolenberg, this Bush clone, raised $3 million. So she's running again. She's running in the primary. She has one opponent. And let's see if we have her now that I've given full disclosure. Nancy Skinner, are you with us?
Peter Ruby.
Angeline Jordan is with us, too. How you doing?
I'm great. You know, hey, I am tough, and we're running a great campaign, and I'm so excited about my friend Barack Obama, who's apparently run away with this nomination, in my view.
Well, yeah, you and I were talking a little while ago. We said that if he wins, this looks like he would be, he's got the presidency. So that's your and my prediction?
It has been mine for a long time. I ran against Barack Obama in the Senate primary, so yeah. I know him very well, and I know exactly how they undersampled the polling in his district for turnout. And exactly what we're seeing is that Peter, how they do this, they go likely voters. But Barack has been able to bring unlikely voters to the match. You know? I mean, he brought them in. He's doing great. And
I think
he's stolen from the establishment the mantle of the presidency. How amazing is that?
It is. Now, you know what you've done? Now, if Joe Nolenberg calls the show, I'm going to have to let him on.
No, you don't.
Call a show. You know, you have. I know the equal time restrictions. I know religiously, having been both a broadcaster and a politician, you do not have to have all the candidates on until 30 days before the election. If I call in, which I did, it's just a caller.
Right.
Then, I'm just a citizen.
Sure.
And I'm just a Peter Ruby freaky fan.
So how's your campaign going? You have primary. You have somebody running against you in the primary.
I do. Yes.
Yeah.
The DCCC recruited a very conservative candidate against me. I won. I almost won 57-41% in the last election. No, 47-51%.
Yeah.
And
that's a little better.
Close. I spent 7-1.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And then they recruited a more conservative candidate. This is happening all over America, though. But here's the cool thing. There's a contest going on right now called democracyforamerica.com. It's F-O-R, democracyforamerica.com. And people are able to choose who their favorite grassroots candidate is. And I'm in first place here.
Yeah, and then how many candidates are there?
Well, there were like 40 or something.
That's what I thought. And this is national. So you're in first place?
Yes, I am.
That's amazing.
Go.
I came in second place last time. I lost in the very last seconds of the last runaround to Jerry McNerney, who went on to be Congressman McNerney. He beat his incumbent, and I actually had a chance to visit with him in Washington. And this contest meant a lot to him. It gave him $100,000. So it could be worth a lot more than that now, $100,000 to $200,000.
Sure.
But Peter, you'll appreciate this because it's democracyforamerica.com and you have to go vote. But I had all of our, we've known each other from radio, right,
sure,
for a long time. So I was on Randy Rhoads' show and Tom Athens' show and Mike Malloy's show. I mean, we've all been friends for years and in this business. And so that has helped me. And so because that helped me, and anytime I was on any of those shows, the sites would crash. So now they've extended the deadline a full week to give all the other people who don't have friends with radio shows a chance. Okay, I suppose that's fine. I don't think it's fine. You know, my opponent has the entire resources of the Democratic National Party nationally and locally at his disposal. If I can have my friends who know me in radio say something, but it is what it is. So
Give us the website again.
Say it slowly.
Say it again. Say what?
The name of the website?
It's democracyforamerica.com.
Okay, good.
Okay,
so
we'll vote.
TSA, you know, Howard Dean started this website. Now his brother runs it, Jim Dean.
Yeah.
Oh.
Jimmy Dean.
Yeah, and it's worth a lot. This investment could be to my campaign with $100,000 to $200,000.
Wow.
Yeah. That could, and Peter, you know, could change everything. Because my opponent is kind of the more conservative machine candidate. And I'm watching my friend Barack Obama. You know, I ran against Barack Obama.
Yeah.
If people don't know that, my first race in Illinois, I ran against him. He and I got to be great friends, and he endorsed me. But here I'm seeing him rising to these exalted levels. And I'm just thinking, you know, the possibilities. Possible. You always think it's all money, machines, and we get into that groove, but the last couple of days I'm looking at what has happened to Barack, and I think, you know, he knows. He called me the sharpest opponent in his race and endorsed me.
Yeah.
Heartily.
Well, that's great. Well, listen, so people can go to this site, and in fairness, there's other candidates there. If they want to get a look at those, they can do that as well. But it's democracyforamerica.com.
Right, and the voting ends on February 3rd. They extended it because I was winning. Okay, I was winning. It should have been tonight, midnight. But because I was winning by too much of a margin, they had to extend it. My appeal would be to keep my margin as it is and just, you know, have folks vote for me and get out there. They know me.
And you have a website of your own, right?
Yeah, SkinnerForCongress.com. And the best thing that they need to see, if you have questions about who I am, go to the website. I pulled a beautiful video of me on CNN with Wolf Blitzer. And it's before the war in Iraq, and I'm questioning Wolf and another pro-war host about why we were rushing into war. And were there any motivations other than, you know, national security, like oil, like political motivations? That, in the video, is right there. You just can't, you know, you see me on CNN asking these questions when it was unpopular.
That's right. We were all there. We were all on CNN.
And,
you know,
yeah.
It's kind of we certainly aren't into saying I told you so, even though we told everybody so, because there, you know, there has been so much death, so much destruction, so much money. Well, Nancy, I should move on, but people want to get involved in the pre-election voting selection.
Yes. It ends on February 3rd, democracyforamerica.com.
And skinnerforcongress.com.
Yes.
Thank you, Nancy.
Thanks, Peter Werby.
Appreciate
Love
it.
Ya.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye now. Yeah. So, man, I'd sure love to have her in there than Joan Olenberg.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay, but if her opponent or Joe Nolenberg calls in, put him on. Because, you know, we have station rules about I can't, like, interview any politician running for office as a guest. So we're going to have a couple of guests on, which seems to have disappeared.
Who are not running for office.
Neither of them are. Let's see here.
Chalmers Johnson,
who just has written Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. What a scary title.
And also
Elena Harada, who's the executive director of Detroit Obrera Central, which means workers' center, who's going to be talking about immigration.
Oh, great.
And it's a very, very interesting interview. But, hey, let's get some more callers on. Man, this is, let's see, we got some people been waiting a long time. Let's go to Gerardo in Detroit. Gerardo, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello, hi. As a matter of fact, I just wanted to say you two were the Dixie Chicks of rock and roll and talk radio. That's more or less what it came down to.
Thank you!
You know, I mean, I actually did side with them. I heard many of the different callers and your comments, and I would have to have my own show in order to make a comment on all of them. But the initial comment I wanted to make was the candidates running. I'll just say the male candidates, because I really don't feel like calling them men. Because, and it was true, because one of your callers, he was correct. The first one to throw the verbal stone was Barack Obama at Hillary. And if you notice, months before, when they were having their debates, the Republicans and Democrats, when they were asked a question about what you would do as president, in so many words, their answers were, Hillary won't, but Hillary can't. Oh, you don't want Hillary. And, you know, when I kept hearing all this, it's like, hello, you're not saying what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, basically, you know what all those so-called men were saying?
Right.
She won. Because if you notice, the Republican Party even started their attacks on her last year. This time, last year, she didn't even, it wasn't even out that she was, you know.
Yeah, but I think the Republicans, she's the preferred candidate of the Republicans, because they think she'll be the easiest
person.
They can
beat her.
Yeah, because she's got so many negatives.
Yeah, it's like the bullies in the playground picking on the girl. And that's what I mean. I really don't like that, you know.
And they had to bring up her cleavage. That's what they had to do. Remember that?
And her laugh.
And her laugh.
I mean, that's how bad. But
yeah.
But the whole, look at, the politics in the United States are about money. In other words, Ron Paul or Dennis Kucinich that have serious platforms that we know exactly what they are. They can't even, they don't have enough money to make their voices heard. And so money, Bob Dylan's old lines is money doesn't talk, it swears.
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing is, it's all these sort of the idiosyncrasies of the individual candidate. How do they laugh? Was that a sincere laugh on the part of Hillary? Was it a sincere tear when she cried? And what about when Romney cries?
We say going overboard?
Yeah, what a lot of crap. Because what it should be, there should be a Democratic Party that has a platform as and that they all adhere to that platform. And let the Democrats have their convention and let them select however they want instead of these stupid primaries. For one thing, I'm not a Democrat and I'm not certainly not a Republican.
I'm with you.
And I don't even want to pay for their damn primaries. Why the hell should we have to pay public money for private political parties? I just don't understand it. All right. Thank you very much,
Gerardo. Yeah, well, they raise so much money.
Yeah. 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 Let's see. Here's Zach in Little Rock, Arkansas. Zach, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
The land of Bill and Hillary, yeah.
Right.
Huckabee.
Yeah.
No, hey, Huckabee for president.
Talk about just the issues in Ron Paul in general, and I'll just let you know that I am a Paul supporter. I was wondering, what is it exactly that you don't agree with him on? Because it sounds like you have a lot in common with him.
Well, when you get beyond his most well-known, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but it's all right to revisit,
okay.
Right. Is that, he has this cockamamie libertarian view. He doesn't want Social Security. He doesn't want any health care that's beyond, that's not privatized. And on and on and on. I mean, he doesn't want a minimum wage. He wants to leave abortion up to state decisions. But the majority of people probably in 1972 probably opposed abortion rights, and certainly the state legislatures, which were probably 98% men there, would have maintained the laws against abortion. But it's the national institution that's the final arbiter of what is constitutional. The Supreme Court decided that a woman's right is important. I mean, that would be like states' rights. Remember, that was from the 1950s, that if a state wants to have segregation, that's okay.
Okay, okay. This is the same argument I hear from a lot of people, but, okay, let's start with Social Security, for instance.
Yeah.
He doesn't support it, but because, I don't know if you would agree with me or not, but the government, ever since it's been involved, it seemed to go down. But
what's
kind of irrelevant, because his point is he wants to pay for Social Security for the people who are dependent on it and who have paid in their entire lives. He's not just going to come in and destroy it or stop it.
Well,
he's
not going to do anything, because, as I said, he doesn't have enough money to be a serious player and probably eventually will drop out. Although, even, I mean, the idea of listening to a Republican debate, I mean, I would, I don't know what, I can't imagine, but apparently he opened up with opposing the war and got a huge hand. So, I mean, I would like to see a contest between Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul. The rest of them, I don't have much to say for.
Right, they're all pretty much the same. But the Social Security, what I'm getting at is he's not actually going to do away with it. He would actually fund it. He's just saying he wants to allow the young people like myself to opt out. Because right now my situation is I'm going to pay my whole life, but yet the money's already been spent. There's nothing there. So why not give me a chance to pull out of the program?
Well, the deal is that that leaves a lot of people free-floating. What's happening right now is that the people that are working, like myself, when we pay these FICA taxes, we're paying for our parents' generation and our grandparents' generation. And what it does, it is Social Security. It's not like a crapshoot. Some people are in, some people are out, some people make a lot, some people make a little, some people won't make any. And what it wants to create, as in every other industrialized nation, is a regularized process that when people retire, they have an income that lets them live rather than seniors, which is okay, but there are elders. And what we want to do is guarantee that Social Security for them. And as it is, what we should be talking about is a great rise in what we pay to our seniors, to our elders. And, of course, there's not the money now. Social Security is not in trouble. That's another just right-wing, crap. But what we should be talking about is having a great, great, great amount higher ability to pay. And we don't have it. As long as we have a military-industrial complex, as long as we're lowering the taxes on the ultra-rich rather than raising them dramatically. All right, thanks for calling in from Little Rock. I appreciate it. And let's go to John. John's calling from Dallas, Texas. John, hi. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
How are you doing?
We're doing great.
I just wanted to comment. I definitely don't think that Obama is anywhere near being crowned as the nominee. You have February 5th coming up with these states like California and New York and New Jersey and Massachusetts that have so many delegates at stake, and Hillary is up so much there that even with a bounce out of South Carolina, it's not going to matter that much. I don't think that anyone in the last 3 weeks thought that Hillary would have a chance in South Carolina.
No.
And it's definitely not over. And I think if anyone has the advantage right now, the way that the map is laid out between now and middle of February, it's definitely Hillary.
Well,
and she's not going to be able to be stopped come February 5th.
Well, that will be the telling point. I agree. Bill Clinton just made the remark that Jesse Jackson had won South Carolina in 1984 and 1988, and people hopped on him. There he is, injecting race into the question again. But it's the Democratic vote in South Carolina is heavily African American. So what he was saying, probably he should have just shut up. Probably he should just go home.
I think so.
And stop embarrassing himself. But because what he was saying was accurate, that as I think you're saying, John, that the South Carolina vote probably wasn't, I don't know what, indicative of the votes that are going to come on February 5th, right?
Absolutely. I mean, even Al Sharpton received close to 20% of the vote in South Carolina.
Really?
So it's very racially segregated there. And when you receive 81% of a vote that is over 50% of those voting, as Obama did, you're going to win. You're going to win by a pretty substantial margin.
Yeah.
But you look at the states like California and New York, and a lot of these have closed primaries where only pre-registered Democrats can vote. And those are the ones that are staunchly behind Senator Clinton. And if you examine any of these polls closely, if you actually go in deeper than what you see just on the media, if you go into the second and third questions that are asked in these polls, usually the second question is, well, how strong is your support for that candidate? And Hillary, by far, in every poll that has been taken in every state, out of all the major polling firms, and especially in the Zogby daily tracking polls, which is kind of the benchmark for presidential primary polling, her support is by far the strongest. So,
well, I think as Nancy Skinner, was a candidate here in the 9th Congressional District, was saying, that those polls have a lot of flaws in them, as we see in New Hampshire, as we saw in South Carolina. But you know what? I mean, I don't. In some ways, this probably ends discussion, and my apologies for that. I care about one thing, is that the Democrats come up with the strongest possible candidate so that we don't get another Republican administration. I don't think a Democratic administration is going to solve very much at all, given the major candidates. Maybe Edwards, but I think the change is about as deep as a lawn sign for any of them. And to me, on November, whatever it is in this year, the date, that might be the seventh political thing that I do. Oh, yeah, I got to go vote against the Republicans. So I haven't been following it that closely, other than I just hope that that the Democrats don't snatch defeat from the jaws of victory.
Absolutely. I think Hillary is definitely the candidate that can win in November. I think she's the only one, possibly besides Edwards, that would have that chance.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks for calling in from Texas. And let's see, 313, actually some open lines, first time in a while. 313-298-WRIF, that's 313-298-9743. And I'm getting a little distortion here on my board, but it's a call from Canada, and I can't read your name on the board. Welcome to the show, though.
Oh, hi, my name's Yvonne.
Hi, Yvonne. No, well, all that's up there is like these weird symbols. No?
Yeah. Okay.
Where are you calling from in Canada?
I'm calling from Windsor, across the river here.
We know where Windsor is.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to keep it really short because I've been listening to people discussing a lot of issues. I don't want to take up a lot of your time because I'm just calling with a comment on the format of the show in general. Well, I was listening. Well, first of all, I've listened to you for years, Peter, on and off. I've moved and come back and, different things like that. But I've so appreciated your show. I think you're an extremely intelligent, in some ways I would even say brilliant man. You're providing a format that's very rare out there for discussion and your views and so on that are so seldom actually put out there on the airwaves. So I so much appreciate it. And I was listening a couple of weeks ago. I think it was 2 weeks ago. A woman called in, and she was talking with Julene about, I forget what the exact issues were, but I guess at the end of the call it was somewhat of a discussion of feminism, and Julene said that you are a staunch feminist, and the woman disagreed, and she was kind of all over you.
Right.
I don't
but
know.
But he is.
Yeah,
so
yeah, and I think
that.
So too, from what I hear. And I think that, the woman kind of went all over Peter about, being forgetful, and it was the, called you kind of like,
she was telling
radio.
Him he was stumbling and bumbling.
I can't even remember
the call.
I'm sorry. What?
I said I can't even remember the call.
Because we both get
we both
get ragged on a little bit once in a while. We're used to it.
Oh yeah, I know, but that one really got to me because
I know me
I
too.
Thought, okay,
really?
Yeah.
Now what I wanted to say to kind of narrow it down is that I have I've listened to you for years, and I sometimes tape the show when I can't actually be here to listen to it, and I listen to it later. And I have noticed a change, not in you, Peter, but more that now that the format is, the two of you are discussing together, and before it was Peter, you on your own for many years, that I heard anyway. I would have to say that I don't want to, I kind of miss the old format, I would say, of you being more on your own. And that's not anything against you, Julene. It's more of the dynamic where Peter, when you just seem more focused, more concentrated, more, you get in your own mind and you sort of go on your own monologue, whatever, follow your own train of thought. And you do that so very well. And you get so very deep into, your own path of thought. That's where the brilliance really shines through. And I appreciate it.
Whenever you have two people, you're going to, and you have an interchange. And for one thing, and here's what I think, the only kind of objection that, and I don't know, I don't want to go on too much with this, although I appreciate you bringing it up, Yvonne, is that very frequently, or through a program when there's one individual doing it, like Jolene's going to be doing the show by herself next week, when I'm by myself, I'm speaking only to the listener. I'm speaking directly to the listener.
That's right. Yeah.
When there's Jolene and I are often talking to each other, and the audience is listening.
Right, and it does create a whole different pattern
and so on.
It's completely different, but I appreciate the monologue where you're speaking to the listener. You're able to cover more and get maybe more into the track of things. And I will be listening next week. I'm curious to hear you, Julie, on your own and how it goes for you. And, you know, I may enjoy it very much.
I've
never heard you on your own before. But personally, I think maybe you each could do your own shows, you know?
Like there you go.
There's not enough room in radio. For that many shows on the left, unfortunately.
All said, and I have examined this and thought about it, and I appreciate that, but I guess I like this better. I like doing it with you.
And I hope you're not leaving us, Peter. No. When you say you have a surprise, you know, coming up, I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, he's
going
to quit.
He is not going anywhere.
I'm finally going to fix my nose. No, I'm only kidding. All right, Yvonne, thank you very much. Hey, we got to take a break, and we'll be right back to get your calls. 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. Joining me, of course, Julian Jordan, who will be doing the show next week while I take a Sunday off, and then I'm going to have a surprise now, but it's really good, and I'm not leaving, and I'm not sick, and I'm not getting plastic surgery or anything like that. But it's kind of a special announcement, and I'm not doing a daily show. I don't even want to. Yeah, everybody says, you ought to do more shows. This is it. Once a week. It's great. At 1 a.m., it's coming up in about 23 minutes, minus 5 GMT, or 1 a.m. Eastern Time. My first guest is going to be Chalmers Johnson, who's written the book Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. If you're interested at all about what the real issues in the economy are, this is the guy to listen to. You know, I have these sayings at the top of my page, and they're really good. I got them from listeners, both of them. One is Voltaire, the 18th century French philosopher. It says, anyone who has the power to make you believe absurdities has the power to make you commit injustices.
Ooh,
that's a good one.
That is good.
And the other one, Socrates, way back, he says, the misillusion... That's why it's interesting that I didn't say that right, because the quote is, the misuse of language induces evil in the soul.
Wow.
That's at Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, W-E-R-B-E.com. And let's get back and some more calls for us here. Waiting patiently, Mike in Hamtramck. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I wanted to compliment you on your interview last week of Cable Confidential.
Oh, yeah, with Jeff Cohen, who spoke here yesterday about the Iran war with a United
Nations... Scott Ritter.
Yeah, with Scott Ritter, who was a United Nations weapons inspector. It's one of the reasons I knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. And
he told us.
And he's a Republican, and he's an ex-Marine.
I didn't know the Republican.
Yeah, he voted for Bush in 2000.
No kidding.
Yeah, and there was a meeting with Jeff Cohen and... Scott Ritter yesterday, and hundreds of people came out, over 300 people. But go ahead, Mike.
Well, I missed that, but what intrigued me about it was the fact that how NBC had actually shut these people down, and all of our major media is doing that.
Oh, yeah.
ABC, the parent company Disney, wouldn't release Fahrenheit, 9-1-1, Fox 2, you know, totally to the left on that.
No, well, they always remember. Not Fox 2, not our Fox. They say Fox News,
but, you know,
not Fox 2.
I want to mention, you always say you read the New York Times, but he mentioned how the Times also covered it up.
Oh, yeah, it's for sure. No, the Times did worse. The Times actually perpetrated the myths that Bush was, saying about Iraq. No, they were terrible. One thing is, that's all my fear is, because I quote from the New York Times so frequently that people will think, oh, that's a good source, and they can be trusted. But there used to be a publication called The Lies of Our Times. And so you got to be careful. You got to be careful. I would say one of the better sites to go to is BuzzFlash.com and...
CommonDreams.org.
And CounterPunch.org.
Oh, yeah. BuzzFlash is probably my favorite.
BuzzFlash and Common Dreams has news items that are very, very useful to read. And CounterPunch.org has good commentary, very good commentary. Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
Oh, okay.
Listen up tonight, too, because this Chalmers Johnson interview that's coming up about 20 minutes is terrific. You want to get some last-minute comments on? I think we can get a number of you on at 313-298-WRIF. Danny Glover, this was in the CNN crime section.
Really?
Yeah, it was so weird. Danny Glover has been convicted in Niagara Falls, Ontario, for trespassing in a hotel during a union rally in 2006. Glover, who wasn't in court, was convicted Thursday along with Unite Here, which is the name of the union. Union Representative Alex Dagg and Ontario Federation of Labor President Wayne Samuelson. Canadian Niagara Hotels charged the three with trespassing at their Sheraton on the Falls property during a September 16, 2006 protest. The 60-year-old actor took part in a protest as part of a larger campaign that aims to increase salaries and improve working conditions for hotel workers in the United States and Canada. And the group is called Unite Here, H-E-R-E, represents 50,000 hotel, food service, garment, and manufacturing workers across Canada, 450,000 in North America.
Yeah, we saw a large group of them when we went to that protest in Miami.
We did.
Yeah.
That's right, including my friend, who was kind of upscale, and there he comes out wearing a Unite hat and a Unite t-shirt. Yeah.
Right.
By the way, you know, number one, right?
We're number one in everything awful.
Yeah, well, we hit the skids again. You know, that's kind of weird. You know, you say people, there's very few other countries where people say, this is the best country in the world.
Yeah.
You know, this is the only country that we're in which people say that and chant number one and all that. But U.S. given poor marks on the environment. A new international ranking of environmental performance puts the United States at the bottom of the group of eight industrialized nations and 39th among the 149 countries in the list. European countries dominate the top places in the ranking, which evaluates sanitation, greenhouse gas emissions, agricultural policies, air pollution, and 20 other measures to formulate an overall score. The top 10 countries were Switzerland, Sweden, Norway, and Finland. Yeah, I can't imagine those people going around saying, we're number one, we're number one.
Right.
Pardon me. The others at the top were Austria, France, Latvia. Wow. Costa Rica, Colombia. Colombia? Colombia? Mm. And New Zealand. Daniel Estee, the report's lead author, said that the U.S. continues to have a bottom-tier performance in greenhouse gas emissions. This is disgraceful.
Yes, it is.
All right, 313-298-WRIF. It's Chris and Warren. Hi, Chris. It's Peter and Jolene. Hey, you with us?
Hello.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, how's it going tonight?
It's going excellent.
Yeah, I want to comment on a few things, but I just want to tell you how much I enjoy your show.
Well, thank you so much.
Whenever I get a chance, really, to listen to it.
Yeah.
There's a couple things that I wanted to comment on. I think kind of some of it related to what was said earlier, and basically it was, I think you were touching base on our government surplus as how all this money is being spent to towards like this war or so, but I wanted to share a couple things with your callers as well as you guys in the studio.
Okay.
And I got an actual quote. It's from a book that I want to plug called We Want You to Be Rich. I don't know if you had a chance to read it with Donald Trump and Robert Kiyosaki.
Missed that one.
Okay, you have to pick up the book as well as the other listeners. We all have to be educated as Americans, and then that way we'll prepare ourselves for the future as well as our younger youth. Basically, what it's saying is, according to the Treasury Department, the 42 presidents total combined $1.1 trillion from foreign government as well as financial institutions. Now, what that means is from George Washington's era up to Clinton. And with the Bush administration, which was only a five-year span, Bush has spent a total of $1.5 trillion.
Okay. That's a lot.
Is that making sense? Or?
Yeah, we owe it. Yeah. But okay. By the way, there was not, I mean, there's not a surplus now. We had a surplus in 2000, and Bush ran it into the ground.
Correct.
Right.
So I strongly suggest your listeners to pick up this book and read it. I'm not done with it completely, but it's totally educating me as an American on a lot of different things. And I think another caller mentioned very strongly how you can't rely on our government, and it happens to be true. I mean, the Social Security as well as the pension that my parents had, that's no longer going to be available for my generation, which is X, I believe. The baby boomer generation is going to use a lot of that, so there's not going to be that type of surplus for the government to provide for us when I get ready to retire.
Well, if there's got to be a few adjustments, and it's fine. I mean, the Social Security system and Medicare and all that is in good shape. I mean, there's a specific fund, and it may need a little influx of funds, and that could be easily provided.
Okay. And then the last thing I want to comment, and I'll conclude it with this. Did you watch the news recently where they're talking about the stimulus plan?
Yeah.
Okay. What is your opinion about that? I just want to kind of listen to what you think about it.
Ain't going
to
do much.
And where's the money coming from?
Yeah, where's the money? What are they going to do? Print it? Borrow it?
That's the thing. You answered your question yourself.
Yeah.
The money has lost its value for so long. I mean, everybody's in our country is in a national debt, trillions and trillions of dollars. At one point, gold actually held its value where it's not even that anymore because we print out and produce so much of this money that at any time our government can say, hey, this is no longer any value, and then where are we going to be ending up then?
Well, you know, it's kind of a mystery when you have the value of currencies, what that's all about, but that's pretty complicated. But 5 years ago, the United States dollar and the euro were at par. And now it's the euro is worth 150. And think about that. What's the Canadian dollars? It was at, I think back then, was worth 62 or 64 cents. It's worth now like $1.02. Ain't the way to go about things. And what about the people that are running everything? I mean, couldn't they do better than this? I guess not. They haven't. All right. Thank you very much, Chris. Appreciate it. Donald Trump, everybody's not doing too badly. He's opening up these big condos in Panama.
Oh, is that his latest?
Yeah. And I was looking. You know, what is with him? You know, he's got this ad. Have you played that when you've been doing rock and roll shows?
No.
They're talking about everybody can get rich. Well, everybody can't get rich. It's ridiculous.
That's true.
But he's going to send you a CD.
On how to get his.
What kind of scam
is that?
How many
of those he's going to sell?
Well, why would
many.
Why would he even care? Sell it.
He just wants to make more money.
And I don't know.
It's just never ending with that.
Pardon me. Let's see. All right. Here is another Chris. Chris is in Westland. Chris, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Julian. How are you guys doing tonight?
Good.
Hey, Chris. Good. Thanks.
Hey, do you remember Thomas Paine? He immigrated from England.
I partied with that dude.
And, well, he had two words that a lot of people didn't like, which was independence and republicanism.
Uh-huh.
And I think we've lost that.
But remind people, when he was talking about republicanism, he wasn't talking about the Ronald Reagan and George Bush.
Oh, far from it.
Right. He was
a government that works for the people.
Right. A concept of a republic.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. And it's, we've lost that. And, you know, people have to remember that. And last thing, get out and vote.
Yeah. Oh,
that's
yeah.
The biggest
oh.
thing you can do.
And I see why. It said common sense in quote marks here. That's the Thomas Paine pamphlet.
Right.
That was one of the best sellers of the colonial era. And one,
yes,
of the most, and one of the most and the radical ones at the time as well.
Yes, he was quite radical himself. So.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, thanks, guys.
Appreciate it. And there's a book out. That's right. I interviewed somebody that wrote a book about Thomas Paine's Common Sense. You know, I'm surprised actually people didn't talk more about Kwame Kilpatrick's mayor of Detroit's.
Maybe everyone's just over it.
Yeah, maybe so. But here's one thing we shouldn't get over. I mean, for one thing, why doesn't he just resign? He probably is going to be indicted for perjury, the mayor and all that. But the Texas Attorney General's office agreed Thursday, now this is a while ago, this is like a week and a half ago, to investigate whether Charles A. Rosenthal should lose his job as District Attorney of Harris County for sending and receiving inappropriate messages through his county's email account. And there's another, this, you know, stupidity based on the arrogance of power. Because even he's a Republican, and Republican office holders and party leaders are calling for Rosenthal, a Republican, well, it says Republican, to resign after the release of hundreds of email messages, including love notes to his secretary. And of course, he was another one of these guys professing family values and commitment to
morality,
the church, and all that. Racist jokes and videos of men sneaking up to women and tearing their clothes off in public.
What?
So this whack job is who's the prosecutor of where is the county? This is very important, which is sort of lost in here. But so he's sending love notes to his secretary, racist jokes, and videos of men sneaking up to women and tearing their clothes off in public. He also used the county email to plan his now aborted reelection campaign, which is a violation of Texas law, and hopefully he will be indicted. Now, Rosenthal was first elected in 2000. He has said the death penalty is God's law as well as the state's, and that he follows both, except, you know, when he's dorking his secretary.
Right.
He presides over an office that sends more convicts to death row than any other prosecutor's office in the nation. They're overwhelmingly black and Hispanic.
Oh, we're so surprised by
that. And, well, that wouldn't be a surprise in and of itself. But, of course, we're at a situation where we're looking at a situation where this man is sending racist emails.
Yeah.
Like this is, it's like it's 1950.
For real.
And this guy is sending around, material like that.
Evolve.
Yeah, 60% of the total people executed in the United States last year were in Texas. And the majority of people still support it, even though dozens of men in Texas have been exonerated.
DNA evidence.
Yeah, DNA evidence and all
that. The last one we heard, the guy was in prison for 23 years or something like that.
15th Dallas County inmate since 2001 is freed by DNA.
Wow.
Yeah. And think about that. How many others are there when you have a... How can you trust justice, particularly if you're an African-American or Hispanic and you have the prosecutor that is sending around racist jokes? What confidence could you possibly have? I mean, this is United Nations called for a freeze on the death penalty. The United States opposed it. It was, 104 to 54... Let me see. I thought it was more. Passed 104 to 54, a non-binding resolution calling for a moratorium on the death penalty. Among the countries joining the United States in opposition to the European-led measure, this is the United States is joined by Iran, Myanmar, North Korea, Sudan, and Zimbabwe.
Mm. some company.
Absolutely. All right. Let's take our final calls. Here's Keith in St. Clair Shores. Keith, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF. Hey, are you with us, man?
Oh, you want to click on it there.
Oh, I want to click on it. All right. Hey, Keith. Ah, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, I just want to, I think we can all generally agree that George Bush is the absolute worst president this country's ever had, and he's got us in this terrible war with Iraq. My question, though, is I don't know why we don't see massive protests on all counts, on the college campuses, everywhere. We should just have a day where we just shut down everything and just say, that's it, we've had enough.
Well,
I don't know if it's the media that's suppressing a lot of the things that are starting to rise on the college campuses. I mean, I go to school, and I talk to everybody there, and they're sick and tired of their friends and dying over there for something that's just, you know, not worth it.
Well, you know, it's like a snowball. I mean, it really hasn't started to roll downhill. I don't know why either. During the 1960s, the media was even more closed than it is today, if you can imagine that. Yet people managed to create all sorts of movements during that period. Why it's not happening more? But I mean, I think one of the things happening now is that people are starting to put all their eggs in the basket of electoralism. And as what I said on that November day, hopefully that'll be one of seven political things that I do and not the most important things, because I don't think Barack Obama is going to bring about great change. I don't think Hillary Clinton is going to bring about great change. So as always in American history, if we want great change, it is up to us. We, the people. Got to take one final call. I agree with you completely, Keith. Thanks for calling us. And
maybe start something of your own on the campus.
It's so hard. I agree. You got to do it yourself, but it's people go, I don't know how to do it. What did I do? How do I call a meeting?
Right.
You know what?
Yeah.
Right. Here's Haas in Madison Heights. Hi, you're on the air. Real quick, though.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going? I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
Okay. My question was, well, actually, I wanted to see what you thought about this. But, I mean, looking at the campaign, the political campaign these days, the presidential campaign these days, both on the Democratic and Republican side, you see these people, Obama, Hillary, Huckabee, McCain,
yeah,
whoever, you basically have these celebrities who come on stage and talk about slogans like change and strength, and who don't actually talk about issues that people can base sound judgments on.
Right, right.
So what we have now is we have a black president running, and we have a woman president running, and we have a beltway, or we have a, you know, conservative guy running on the Republican side. So what do you think? I mean people, and the sad thing is the people actually buy these images. They don't actually care what these people have to say about anything, really. I mean, look at Hillary's record, and I'm not going to go...
Well, let me say this. First off, unfortunately, this is... You make a lot of good points, but I'm completely out of time. How many people are fooled? I don't know. How many people are just sort of attracted to the imagery of change by the nature of, quality that the person has physically? Yeah, doesn't make a lot of sense. But I think people are so tired of what, are so exhausted by 8 years of malfeasance and misfeasance on the part of Bushco that anything looks good. Thanks for being our last caller. I appreciate it. Jolene Jordan, are you ready to do the show next week by yourself?
I'm ready.
It's easy for you to be ready because you've done it lots of times before, right?
That's right.
Okay, so I'm not going to be here. Big surprise when I get back.
Stay tuned.
Oh, yeah, Al, thank you so much. Couldn't do it without you, for sure. And stay tuned for the Chalmers Johnson interview, which I think is extraordinarily important.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. You're listening to WRIF.com.
So ever feel
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. I think if I said we were going to talk about the current economic crisis, probably a lot of people would switch the dial. We've heard so much about this in the last week or so. The crisis is upon us, the problems are, what we have to do to weather it and all that. And we're not getting very deep into what's really going on or the potential for solutions. Now, I came across an article at TomDispatch.com, a site I would highly recommend. It's called Going Bankrupt, Why the Debt Crisis is Now the Greatest Threat to the American Republic. I read through it and I thought, this is something that has to be heard. Maybe I'll just take the whole half hour and read it. On the other hand, I thought maybe a better idea would be to reach the author, Chalmers Johnson. And Chalmers Johnson is joining us from Cardiff, California. Welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
And I should tell people that you taught for 30 years between 1962 and 1992 at the Berkeley and San Diego campuses of the University of California. You held the endowed chairs in Asian politics at both. At Berkeley, you were the chairman of the Center for Chinese Studies in the Department of Political Science.
Yes.
Let me tell people, this is kind of a long introduction, but this will all have bearing on what Chalmers Johnson is going to tell us today. From 1968 until 1972, he served as a consultant to the Office of National Estimates of the Central Intelligence Agency. He is a former U.S. Navy officer and has written some 17 books. In 2006, if you saw that, remember we had a showing of that, folks, at the main theater. And I hosted it, but Chalmers Johnson appeared in the prize-winning documentary film Why We Fight. His most recent books are Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire, The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, and he has his latest book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, is out now in paper. With all of that, welcome to the broadcast, Chalmers Johnson.
Thank you very much for such a generous introduction.
Well, I hardly know where to begin with this. In your article on TomDispatch.com, right, you talk about three broad aspects to our debt crisis. Maybe you could run over those as a way of beginning our discussion.
Well, let me just put it more generally. That is, we have this continuous discussion of the probability of a recession. It may, George Soros says that it may be the most serious recession for 50 years. It does look like it's going to be deep. There are unprecedented things already happening, including the largest single cut in the prime rate by the Fed in its history, 0.75%, not at a regular meeting. But what is not being said, what is just totally unmentioned in our discussions of all this, and instead we keep talking about consumer spending and things of this sort, is military Keynesianism, the use of the military budget to sustain our economy, and the use of the military budget as a jobs program, how long it has gone on that the most important manufacturing activity in America has been something that contributes neither to consumption nor to productivity, namely to weapons making. That we, between the late 1940s and 1996, we spent, it's hard to imagine a figure like this, but well over $5 trillion on nuclear warheads. At the height of I document all this in the article in Tom Dispatch, at the height of our nuclear stockpile in the late 1960s, we had over 35,000 usable atomic and thermonuclear warheads. We never used one, fortunately, but it's a perfectly good example of what John Maynard Keynes was talking about, the use of government expenditures in order to provide jobs.
And that's what Keynesianism is, right?
That's what it is.
Yeah.
He never, ever used the phrase military Keynesianism, and obviously didn't like it. It means the attempting to sustain a capitalist economy by frequent wars, massive military expenditures, exactly the sorts of things that President Eisenhower, in his famous farewell speech of 1961, warned us against, and he gave it the famous phrase that he invented, the military-industrial complex. That is, one of the things I am at pains to get at today is how deeply it has penetrated our society, how over time this kind of military expenditures drains sources away from the civilian economy. that we are actually having pundits in Washington, D.C. now talking about the need to cut back on Social Security, on Medicare, and things like that, because they're starting to crowd out the military budget. That if we continue to take care of our people in a halfway decent manner in this country, not as decent as it is in most advanced industrial democracies, but if we try, we won't be able to continue to fund our military activities at over $1 trillion a year. That's the size of everybody else's military expenditures on Earth combined.
Oh, wait. When Chalmers Johnson, you said $1 trillion a year, I thought the military budget was like half a trillion.
Then the general rule by many people is that once that's announced, you should always double it. But the basic thing is that it's deceptive. We continue to hide military-related expenditures in other departments. That half a trillion, that $500 billion approximately, or $600 or $700 as it is right now, is just that of the Department of Defense. It doesn't include nuclear weapons, which are all in the Department of Energy. It doesn't include the care of our wounded veterans, some of which are unbelievably expensive and require a lifetime of care. That's in the Department of Veterans Affairs. It doesn't include foreign military sales. That's in the Department of State. It doesn't include interest payments on wars going back to the First World War, which is $200 billion a year. It doesn't even include, of course, basic defense of the country, which is now given over to the Department of Homeland Security since on September 11, 2001. It was so patently demonstrated that the Department of Defense doesn't have much to do with the defense of the country.
Have things changed dramatically during your lifetime? You're a former U.S. Navy officer. You were a consultant to the CIA. Have things altered significantly?
Yes. There's no question that we always overstated the threat from the Soviet Union. We convinced ourselves back in 1950, when we were really extremely anxious in this country, we knew full well that war production during World War II is what had finally overcome the Depression. We were very much afraid that with the return of peace, demobilization, that the Depression would return, and that in 1950, as we outlined our basic strategy for the Cold War, we committed ourselves to both guns and butter, to a new military industry that would include everything from nuclear submarines to atomic weapons, to outer space satellites, one thing after another. These new industries would be directly related to the military establishment. We began to drain resources from our scientific establishment and concentrate them in weapons and weapon production. Again, these are worthless things. They don't add to wealth, productivity, or things of that sort. It was really early as the 1960s we began to notice the effects of this, as we saw countries like Japan began to pull away from us in terms of the quality of consumer electronics, automobiles, things of this sort. They were spending, you know, minuscule amounts on armed forces compared with the fact that we are clearly the world's largest expenditure on the military. It, over time, it's gotten out of control. It brought down the Soviet Union in 1991. We wrongly concluded that we had won the Cold War. The truth of the matter is both superpowers were being sapped by the imperial overstretch of maintaining the Cold War. They went first because they were always poorer than we were, but we're beginning to toy with exactly the same kind of things that happened to the Soviet Union between 1989 and 1991.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, something very serious happened. Russia today is a much smaller country than the former Soviet Union was. It's these are the sort of things that I'm warning about, that it's gone on so far now that, as I say, we've corrupted our Congress in the sense that they virtually perform no oversight whatsoever on the defense budget, because they have a vested interest today in placing factories, military bases, research units, things of this sort, in one or another constituency. The military-industrial complex understands this. On big projects like, say, the B-2 bomber, they do everything in their power to locate these things in as many different constituencies as they possibly can, with the understanding that if some member of Congress got the idea that we didn't need a new weapon of mass destruction or a war every 5 or 10 years, we can put them out of office. That's the kind of thing that has gotten us into trouble today, and it looks very much like what happened to the former Soviet Union in the 1980s.
My guest is Chalmers Johnson on the Peter Werby Show. His latest book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, is just out in paperback. In the title of your book, Nemesis, a long-standing enemy. Who is the nemesis here?
Well, Nemesis is the ancient Greek goddess of retribution, the punisher of hubris, of getting beyond yourself, of failing to remember limits, of the kind of things that we started to talk about during the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that we were, that we could dominate the world through military force alone, that we no longer needed allies, international law, or things of this sort, that we were the lone superpower, full spectrum dominance, the Air Force started to talk about. All of these have the signs of getting beyond yourself, of failing to understand what really is necessary, and we are paying tremendous costs for it today, not least of which is we have bought for ourselves the reputation as the most hated nation on earth.
Now, we don't. This is being recorded. We don't have phone callers, but probably someone would call up and say, "Wait a minute, Chalmers Johnson, you're talking about a war economy and a military-industrial complex, but we're facing a crisis because of the mortgage subprime, the crisis, the overall indebtedness. Why are we off on this military budget?"
Because we could fix these problems of things that are slowing us down. The fact that we're losing jobs like crazy overseas, that we don't manufacture much anymore except weapons, that we're losing radically our competitiveness in the world. The reason that's true is because we have crowded out way too much of our civilian economy, investment in civilian products. Today, we have, by orders of magnitude, the world's largest trade deficits. There's no other country that even comes close to the amount we're putting on the tab from foreigners. And it's manufactured goods. They're big medical equipment and things of this sort. We have the need for proton accelerators and radiological therapy and things of this sort as much as anybody else does. We don't make them in this country, however. They're made in Germany, Japan, in Belgium, places like that. This is what I'm trying to warn against. The number of young people in our universities who are working in applied sciences like engineering and find there are simply no jobs except in the military-industrial complex, making weapons, servicing this, our empire of 800 military bases around the world, that's expensive.
Sure.
And it's costly. As Herb Stein, who was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors in the Nixon administration, rather famously once said, things that can't go on forever don't.
Now,
and that's us right now.
As we look to the run-up of the primary elections, we have a number of candidates on the Republican and the Democratic side. Is anyone addressing this? Certainly what you said about the bases. Ron Paul does on the Democratic side. Dennis Kucinich talks about the...
But it's astonishing how well they have done, since they usually would be thought of as sort of Ralph Nader-like also-rans. It's quite amazing. I have the feeling that the public is well ahead of the politicians.
Sure. You mean
Paul Kucinich, people like that.
Yeah. In your series, Blowback, The Cost and Consequences of American Empire, The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of Empire, and your book now in paperback, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. I mean, this sounds pretty ominous. And when you say the last days... that has a pretty, like I say, ominous ring to it. When you say last days, what comes?
Well, let me indicate exactly what I mean. I mean, of course, it's alarmist, and I am trying to sound an alarm. Our country, our constitutional system, our checks and balances, the things that guarantees us from tyranny and dictatorship, were very largely copied after the Roman Republic. The authors of the Constitution understood it very well. They took numerous ideas from it. Veto is a good Latin word, meaning I refuse. Things like that. What happened to the Roman Republic? Well, it inadvertently, rather thoughtlessly, acquired an empire. And with that empire, its inescapable accompaniment, militarism, which subtly altered the Roman Republic and gave rise to the military populace, of which the most famous example is Julius Caesar. All he wanted was to be life dictator. He was assassinated for creating himself as life dictator, but his successor, his grandnephew, a truly ruthless man, Octavian, became the first Roman emperor, Augustus, who abolished democracy. It didn't and ruled as a military dictatorship. It didn't return for well over 1,000 years. Once you lose it, it's really lost. You don't get it back. That's what I'm trying. What I stress in Nemesis is that there's one truly unstable combination that history warns us against. It's a domestic democracy and a foreign empire. You could be one or the other, but you can't be both. If you're going to try and be a democracy, you've got to get rid of your empire, as the British did after World War II, in order largely to preserve their democracy. They couldn't continue to rule India strictly just at the point of a rifle. But in most cases, what happens is you decide to keep your empire, and what you do is you lose your democracy. That's what I'm talking about, is already we have paid enormous costs in terms of the imperial presidency, of the checks and balances, of the intrusion of the military-industrial complex into our daily life, into a dysfunctional Congress that we can't fully trust any longer, into these ruinous expenses because of vested interests in the military. Virtually three-quarters of what the military spends has absolutely nothing to do with the security of the United States. It's devoted to crazy research that doesn't seem to be very well scientifically founded in outer space activities and things of this sort that keep coming back to haunt us. We build airplanes that were designed to thwart the Soviet Union that has been gone for over 15 years. We don't even ask ourselves anymore on huge, expensive projects whether it has anything to do with national security or not, because that's not its point. It's a jobs program. It's what keeps our economy functioning. And that's precisely what's wrong, because you can't build a successful, flourishing capitalist economy on the basis of buying things that have no contribution to consumption or production.
Mm-hmm. Well, things are altered somewhat. We talk about Rome or the empires of Spain or Belgium, yes, or the Netherlands or England or France. They looted other regions to enrich the metropole, the homeland.
By truth.
This is sort of the opposite's going on now.
To a certain extent, it is draining us just as much as the Soviet Empire drained the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and I was thinking, too, about now the increasing foreign investment in the United States, something that the United States always tried to do. I mean, we would overthrow governments in,
yes,
Guatemala in order to maintain the ability of, say, like United Fruit to continue operating there. And
the first reaction of our big financial institutions to the subprime crisis mismanagement of real estate has been to go abroad and borrow huge amounts of money from foreign governments.
Well, yeah, and I mean, how long can that go on? I mean,
they're not borrowing the money; they're selling the company to Middle Eastern sheikhdoms in the Persian Gulf.
Well, we also borrow money every day in order,
yes,
to just keep operating.
Amount.
Yeah. So there's a book, it's out of my mind right now. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Conservative historian Paul Kennedy, I think his name.
Oh, yes, of course.
Well,
yes.
It's something about the consequences.
The rise and decline of the great power.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So
he's the man who invented the concept imperial overstretch.
Okay. And so we're there, right?
Exactly. That is precisely what I'm trying to say, that this study of history and political science is concerns people making bad mistakes. You'd like to think that empires go on for a long time, but in my lifetime, I've seen the collapse of the Nazi Empire, the Imperial Japanese Empire, the Italian Empire, the British, French, Dutch, Portuguese, the Soviet empires. They fall these days with the speed of FedEx.
I like that. Chalmers Johnson is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. His latest book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, is out in paper. I'll have a link to it on my website, Peter Werbe, Werbe.com. It seems, though, those European, well, and Asian empires were so overstretched militarily. But like Ron Paul, for instance, and I think Kucinich as well, says, We could end this by just bringing home or ending our financing of 800 foreign bases.
Precisely. I mean, we don't need them. They're largely relics from previous wars. We've been in Okinawa, which there's never have been any military activity since the Battle of Okinawa in 1945. We have 37 bases in an island smaller than Kauai in the Hawaiian Islands, much to the distress of the people who actually live there. We don't understand that distress because we don't have foreign military bases in the United States. But well over 130 countries around the world now do have them. And it's the sort of thing that has ruined our reputation, that foreigners encountering Americans today are not likely to encounter American businessmen or American diplomats or
tourists.
Or even tourists. What they encounter are heavily armed young men, 18 to 24 years old, who believe that they are there to do good, but who also behave like young men.
Now, I could imagine people listening and just getting more and more discouraged and thinking, these are forces that are in operation, institutionalized forces of the economy and the political system
right.
that bolsters it, and say, gee, well, I'm sitting here in Detroit or Oak Park or St. Clair right. Shores and thinking, why don't we just kind of kiss it all goodbye?
Well, you don't want to overstate it. I hope I'm not wasting my time. I'm obviously depressed by it. That is to say, I do not see that any president of either party could truly resist the power today of the military-industrial complex or of the 16 secret intelligence agencies that are essentially beyond any form of democratic oversight and demonstrate to us almost every day how out of control they actually are. But at the same time, it's worth trying. It's not unknown in this country that we've had a response from below of the public to very serious dangers, as in the progressive movement of the early part of the 20th century and things of this, or the civil rights movement of the 1960s. We need to mobilize inattentive citizens to what they are in danger of losing, and that once they lose it, they'll never get it back. And it's something very valuable they're about to lose, namely our functioning democracy. We've lost enough of it as it is already. And what worries me is that I don't see that the political system is responsive. I am anything but thrilled by the thought of replacing a Bush dynasty with a Clinton dynasty. I fear that is not responsive to the crisis that we do face. I mean, the things that we could do right at once. We could reverse the Bush tax cuts of 2001 and 2003 on the richest Americans and start paying for some of these things that we're doing around the world. Now, we could start closing over 800 military bases when conceivably even to maintain elementary military stability around the world, we might need 35 of them. Not 800 of them. We could certainly quit using the defense budget as a jobs program and cut it back radically. There's huge amounts of money there that could be used at once to reverse our truly declining public education system, the fact that we don't supply health care to very large portions of our public, the crumbling infrastructure, the failure of Katrina in New Orleans, these kinds of things that are scandals that we're getting, unfortunately, getting used to. We're beginning to live like third world people who think this is natural. This is the way things are. They don't have to be that way. We could make some big changes very, very rapidly. I don't see we're getting leadership.
Well, we're not, and it may be just up to all of us rather than thinking there's nothing we can do, because the British Empire, as I remember it, began to unravel in 1776. We've done it before. We can do it again. Thank you so much for being with me. Chalmers Johnson has been my guest. His latest book is now in paper, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. It's published by Metropolitan, and I'll have a link to it on my website, Peter Werbe, Werbe.com, PeterWerbe.com. Chalmers Johnson, thanks for having joined me.
Mr. Werbe, I appreciate your invitation.
Looking out there!
The pictures, the podcast,
the vlog,
the special features you just don't get
anywhere else.
Super freaking cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I shall lose yourself.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks. WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you as usual. We're moving into this dreadful primary season that seems to go on forever, listening to the candidates fight one another over this and that, and some of the issues extraordinarily important. One that has diminished among the people vying for the nomination in their particular parties is that of immigration. The Republicans have talked more about that, and it's a continuing issue, but one that has diminished significantly in importance to the American people, particularly now as we're entering this this troubled economic period, and also the Iraq War continues. But the issues of immigration, the larger issues, people coming here as undocumented workers, their work here in the United States, what rights they do or don't have once they are here, these are whether they should have amnesty, citizenship, I've heard people say they should all be sent back, those people that listen to the execrable Lou Dobbs, if you'll excuse me for taking a very strong opinion on a man who is probably just making our sense of the situation and trying to make sense of it even worse. But someone has joined me here in the studios that's going to help us make a good sense of this. She is Elena Harada, and she's the director of Detroit Central Obrero. And Elena Harada, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you.
And have you felt that problem? Maybe not as much in the Southwest side, that immigration has diminished as an issue?
In the presidential debates and campaigns?
Or just in the life of people that are there? And
absolutely not. There's been an increase in police presence and roundups. And detentions? No, absolutely not. Immigration in the community where I live is extremely high on everyone's list and very frightening.
Yeah, tell us some. From time to time we hear about raids at places of employment, and how are these initiated? I mean, why does the government, the immigration service, decide, okay, we're going to go to this employer? Do they get tips, or do you have any idea?
No, I don't know, and I don't know if anyone knows the answer to that, including the government. But I do think this, and this is what our observations have been, as a group of activists who work in Southwest Detroit, who live in the community, who come from immigrants. Some of us are immigrants, and some of us are descended from immigrants. But what we do see is that the Border Patrol and the police and all the various agencies of law enforcement go less to employers than they do to people's homes, knock on the door and take them away. Hmm. On Friday, I received a call from a director of a Head Start program who was trying to help a father find his the woman who was tracked down. They knocked on the door, took her away, and there were four small children in the house. He got home from work and saw his children unattended, didn't know where the woman was. And because there's a group of us that work with people with all manner of immigration issues, we were able to help track her down because there's a place where they take women.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the people who are picked up in Detroit, Toledo, Grand Rapids, and all those places, there's only one detention center for women, which is in Battle Creek at the Calhoun County Jail,
yeah.
Which we found out the hard way by trying to call places all night long and track people down.
And was she in the country as an undocumented worker, person, or illegal immigrant?
Yes, she was undocumented, and she has four children who were born here.
So they are American citizens.
Yes, they're all American citizens.
Well, how does one sort that out? I mean, I think that many people in the audience, particularly, as I said at the introduction to our show, are so concerned about the nature of the economy, and they see an illegal immigrant population of putting even more pressure on jobs, and hence have very little sympathy for people that they see are, A, breaking the law, and, B, maybe direct threat to their economic standing.
That's a good point, and I sympathize with that. I mean, we live in Detroit. It's the number one highest unemployment capital in the nation. So, obviously we've lost a lot of jobs in auto. I do want to say this, though, and a couple of the parts suppliers that got raided where we worked with the people who got picked up or fired from their jobs, the parts suppliers that provide parts for the big three particularly, but also Toyota and all the other places, and Lear, employ huge numbers of undocumented persons. And I've seen a raid at one in particular. I'll just talk about this one because it's kind of a cookie cutter of all the other situations. First, I want to talk to people, particularly from here, those of us who are working class U.S. citizens, people like us who depend on these jobs, have been able to make a decent living here in the promised land, as I call it. We came to Detroit and we could live without owning land, without coming from rich people, without having a lot of education, without having anything. If we were willing to work hard, we were able to come here and make a living. Well, when these parts suppliers got raided, trust me when I tell you that they didn't then get rid of all their Mexican immigrant workers and hire a whole bunch of U.S. citizens and pay them what they used to make, pay them the benefits they used to make, start paying into Social Security, FICA, and everything else. The parts suppliers did not do that, and they're not going to do that. Those jobs are gone from here. We're not going to see those high-paying jobs here in the U.S., particularly in Detroit, we're not going to see those kinds of manufacturing jobs come back here at the rate that they were. So getting rid of the people who are working for lesser wages doing that, sending half of their money home because their jobs have been taken because of NAFTA, which was ushered in by President Clinton, those are the kinds of things we must be really... I'm asking people to look beyond what you see in the newspaper. The reason there are no jobs, the reason there is no money here is because of the war. Everything else is a distraction from that. Mexican immigrants going away and going back to Mexico are not going to bring back those jobs. People are here because they're desperate, and we're looking at the wrong thing. I want to call out to the Carpenters Union. Thank you very much for asking the Attorney General to take away Mexican people's driver's license, because state police, all the other police agencies that are patrolling the highways, do not know a citizen from a non-citizen, and we're all going to be getting pulled over because of that. Everybody is going to be targeted. Carpenters, I want to tell you, thank you very much. It sure beats organizing, doesn't it?
I hear some, and this is an understatement, some sarcasm and some bitterness. There's always been in this country a tension between immigrant labor and American-born labor. I mean, going back over 100 years. And what it amounts to is just sort of scrambling at the bottom for the crumbs, doesn't it?
It does. It does. I want to say that I think that the U.S. labor movement is very important. It has always played an important role. I come from auto workers for generations. All of our life here in the U.S. has been in Detroit and coming out of the UAW.
And you've been a union organizer, union president.
I've been a union president. I'm a union organizer. And I absolutely believe that unions are the salvation of working people, that the working class are the people who carry the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean the U.S. auto workers. That doesn't mean carpenters. That means people who work, people who create wealth, carry the world. All of us all over the world. And if we lose our connection to that, then we have been fooled. We've been really fooled into thinking into distractions on who the enemy really is.
Elena Harrod is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. She's the director of Centro Obrero, which means Workers' Center, and we may talk a little about that later. When you positioned yourself as an American of several generations, of being part of the union movement, and then on the other hand, there are people who are breaking the law by entering the United States illegally, and yet you have a great sympathy for these people, you work with them, you take up their cause. Some people would say that's a contradiction.
And maybe it is a contradiction. I think it was a contradiction that the U.S. labor movement and the Democratic President Clinton passed NAFTA, which forces people to leave their homelands. People were not wanting to leave home. Nobody wants to leave home, travel across horrible conditions through deserts, across borders, and have to take the most substandard jobs in the most substandard living conditions and live in places where they're going to be hated on because they're poor. And because they're seen as the people who are taking jobs away from U.S. citizens. Now, perhaps it is a contradiction. Remember also that slavery was legal. Slavery was an economically supported, you know, that's what created the wealth of this country, and that was legal. And runaway slaves were fugitives from the law. Remember that, and I'm talking to everybody. When there's laws that are so unjust that they must be opposed, I'm asking people to look to their highest conscience and look at who the real enemies are. Don't accept at face value. When someone tells you to hate on somebody, you should be examining that message right from the beginning.
Well, if that we even as hold as a high value, and I hope most of us do, sometimes I'm afraid most of us don't, but I would always hope most of us do, that of compassion. And these are people that have been driven from their land, as you accurately say, by the terms of NAFTA and all that that's created, particularly corn farmers and people whose traditional lives have been ruined. And the spirited ones just go into the slums of Mexico City, of Veracruz, or something like that. The ones with real ambition, with the qualities we admire, they say, I'm going to go where the jobs are. I'm going to go where the money is to support my my family and to have them have a decent life. But the fear would be, and you see this in the Lou Dobbs and his noisy followers, that we're going to be overrun by Hispanics, that there's going to be, I mean, I had a guy writing me, when's it going to be all right or not be all right, Pete, when there's 15 million 20 million, 30 million of them. So at some point, right? I mean, is there a point at which we have to say, all of us, this isn't working?
Yeah, I'm going to explain a little bit of history here, too, because I think that's an important point. First of all, I'm not going to get into a lot of a lecture, but it's important to understand. And I talked on a radio program the other day in a somewhat of a debate with the state representative from the 71st District, Grand Ledge, who has really pushed this driver's license issue and taking undocumented immigrants off the road so that they can't get a passport to get on a plane and blow it up, which was kind of a stretch because most migrant workers and most people who are immigrants are not interested in blowing up any planes anywhere.
No Al-Qaeda members among, so far, that we've ever heard of.
No, I don't think that's a big threat. But, you know, that's the front that they're using to take people off the road. But the issue is, and the guy kept on saying to me, we welcome immigrants all around the farms where the crops have to be picked. Well, the history of Michigan is such that Mexican immigrants were brought here by various programs, the Bracero program and all different kinds of programs to pick sugar beets in the fields, and were allowed to come as guest workers, as braceros, and return to Mexico. They were there only to keep the crops. In the history of Michigan in the 20s and 30s, when our families first arrived here to work in auto, there was a lot of debate in Congress about limiting Mexican migration so that people could only come and work in the fields and in the crops. Well, they're really trying to create an environment where Mexicans are still only allowed to do that work. And although that work is important and it's worthy work, mm-hmm. we don't want to be consigned to the farms. We don't want to be consigned to living in substandard conditions and having our children work in the fields. They're part of our family, but our family has grown, stayed, expanded, and we have a right to go to school. We have a right to be doctors and lawyers, carpenters. We have a right to do more things than pick the crops and go home and disappear. And to have a state representative in 2008 reflect the same thing that the state representatives of 1927 were saying, and that's that you're welcome to come here during the summer and pick our crops and leave. I have to say that, I'm calling this out to all of the working class people in Michigan, how would you feel if that's all you were allowed to do and if that was the only thing that was on the horizon for your children? How would you feel if you were being told you don't have a right to drive because you might drive off of the farm and into the city and look for a better life or go to a museum or go to a library? How would you feel if that were you?
Well, let's go back to that question. In fact, Michigan Secretary of State Terry Lynn Land, who oversees the Motor Vehicle Department, announced this new policy which said Michigan will no longer let illegal immigrants get driver's license. And there's about seven other states that do allow that. The rest of the states, no. In fact, this was an issue in New York State where Governor Spitzer was close to getting thrown out of office. Something like 80% of people said no. I mean, and the common sense approach to it on the face of it would be, if these people are in our country illegally, how can they be allowed to legally drive? Or why should they be? People also fear it's like a step to legalization or amnesty or citizenship.
Or having a normal life.
Okay.
Right. Well, it's interesting because when people cross the border through because of desperate conditions and they come and work, and they generally work for a very low wage, they're not compensated for any injuries they may get at work, because in Michigan, undocumented workers are not covered by workman's compensation, which is a big boost to employers wanting to hire people, particularly in construction, carpentry, and all those areas. If the people who were losing those jobs fought that alone, they would find themselves on a much more even playing field, because employers love to not have to be responsible for people's injuries when they don't provide any kind of health and safety on the job. We see people with terrible injuries get deported, becoming then a burden to themselves and their family when they had been the only breadwinner to their families. Now, what I'm saying to you is, if you look at that situation and the people are coming to work, they buy car insurance. You have to get tags and plates. Okay, take maybe 100,000 people off of the road. It doesn't mean that they're not going to work anymore. They have to work. They were desperate. So now you have an increase of drivers who are going to have to run away from the scenes of accidents, or maybe just constant profiling of police looking for people who look like they might be Hispanic and pulling them over to make sure that they don't have a driver's license. What are we getting at here? What's the point of this?
Yeah. Well, I think there is an extraordinary amount of frustration on the part of the American public. Again, I'm not sure that that there's it's more than fears. In other words, it's, as you know, that it's been whipped up very conveniently by a number of politicians, by TV personality like Lou Dobbs, and who's he's a millionaire because of his anti-immigrant status, but. You know, sometimes when I do like phone-in talk shows, I say, what's your solution? I say, well, I'll go for any solution you have, good or bad. Citizenship to, as people have said, rounding up all 12 million. And you know, and, well, let's start with that one. I mean, well, let me just tell you a quick little story. One time, someone said we ought to round up all 12 million of them, and I said, good idea. And well, maybe we can put them in camps on the border. We'll concentrate them there. Yeah, so we have concentration. So they're going, yeah, that's a good idea. When someone says, let's round up 12 million, I mean, of course, you'd have to round up the Canadians and the Poles and the Irish.
Not them.
Yeah, okay. Well, do you have any solid figures, Elena Harada, on who's who among undocumented workers?
No, but I will tell you this. I go often to help people when they've been detained or someone in the family has been detained, to help them track down their loved ones and go through the whole process of posting a bond and going to court and going before a judge and everything else. And when a couple of years ago, I was one of very few people in the community who, I've been trying to get people to sort of make this connection and understand what the situation is. But there's also something that happens here. When you talk about taking 12 million people out of the population and removing them, you're not talking about just isolating people. When somebody is picked up out of my community, that's my neighbor who might be married to another one of my neighbors who now has children. We're talking about people who have lives. When I talk to people at immigration, when they're sitting there waiting for a judge's order to be deported, many of them are saying, I don't have a life anywhere else. My life is here. Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody there. I haven't been anywhere else. When our families were repatriated during the 20s, they were plucked out of Detroit and sent to Mexico where they had never been. They had never been there. They were born in Detroit, and they were sent to Mexico where they lived for 2 years without being able to go to school, without having any health care, nearly starving. Many died. And when finally they returned, they started all over again. They were U.S. citizens, and this happened to them because of people like Lou Dobbs and people like the reporters from the Free Press and the news who can put all kinds of anti-immigrant sentiment out there. And I'm saying, take a closer look at the human beings who we're talking to. When I go to court now with people who are in immigration detention, I see black people, white people, all kinds of different folks picking up their neighbors, posting bond for their neighbors. I didn't see this a couple of years ago because immigrants were isolated. When you take people out of our community, they are missed. They are people who work, have kids in school, shop at the stores, help, build Detroit. Look at Detroit.
Sure.
Look at how Detroit has been built since immigrants have come. In the last 15 years, if you look at Verner Highway, it's vital. It's vibrant. There's a business in every single storefront. There was once a vacant storefront. There are no vacant houses. I would swear there are no vacant houses. Everybody will take anything, take nothing and make something out of it and turn it into a home. It's a vibrant location. It's a vibrant community. And what are we talking about? Removing that, getting rid of the people so that they can't do that, so that they'll be cast into further starvation, and then Detroit begins to suffer?
Yeah, I mean, if you think when I was obviously making allusions to the roundups in Germany of the Jewish population, that was only 6 million, 12 million people. You couldn't do it. Or you'd have to turn this into the biggest Stalinist, Hitlerian police state that's ever existed on the face of the earth.
You couldn't do it. Talking about 12 million people now, but they're also intermarrying, intermingling with U.S. citizens of all sorts. Those are our families and our relatives.
What about the idea, though, of that's been floated on the other far end of it, which is just grant citizenship to everyone? And the argument against that is that you'd be rewarding illegal behavior. People are jumping the line; they're not waiting their turn.
That's absurd, and I'll tell you why that's absurd. We hear that, I hear that even in my own family. That how would you? What about rewarding then people who cross illegally? That's like what you're saying then is you're really what you would really be doing is treating the most desperate and the people who have already begun to build their lives here. There's people who have been here for years whose children have no other home but the U.S., who have no other home but Detroit, who are going to get deported and their children won't be here.
Yeah.
Those are U.S. citizens. This is another repatriation. In terms of the other countries where people are waiting, there's all kinds of reasons for that. Maybe they're not coming to the U.S. Maybe they're crossing into the countries that are closest to their borders. But people act in desperation, not because they're criminal.
Yeah, and actually there's a New York Times article, Legal Immigrants Facing a Longer Wait, and it's years even for people that are trying to. Isn't it the majority of people that are in this country illegally are people that have overstayed their visa, that actually came here legally. We usually see, you know, people coming across the Arizona desert or something, but the majority of them, and as I alluded to earlier, there's a great number of Europeans that are here illegally.
Right. Well, you know, the immigration laws have always traditionally been very racist, and they've always been aimed at being able to control migration from different countries. The Chinese were excluded. The Mexicans have been relegated to migrant camps. Africans, obviously, and it's amazing to me that they can even call any Africans from the continent undocumented after 300 years of slavery in the U.S. It's amazing to me that there isn't a different approach to the policies on immigration toward Africans, which is a whole other discussion. But to say that immigration favors European migration because there's still a sense that European immigrants are superior immigrants to other people of color. It's a very, very uneven policy of immigration, and I invite anyone to look at the U.S. immigration policy throughout the years. The history of it is very important.
Lynn Harada, we actually, this has gone by so quickly, and it's such an important issue. We have only about 2 minutes left, and I don't know if this is fair, but I'm almost turning it over to you. What would you like to tell people? I think you've and hopefully have neutralized a lot of the most negative stereotypes and terrible arguments that people have against people, you know, our fellow workers that have come here from Mexico. Any legislation, local programs,
Mainly what I would like to really ask for people to think about is to always consider the source, consider the interest involved in the source. That's anything that tells you that somebody is an enemy should always be examined very closely. Anyone who tells you that someone is different than you and therefore should be treated differently, really look at that and consider the source for that. When you think about Mexican migration, look at NAFTA, and there's another element of NAFTA that's coming into being now that's going to cause another several million people to have to cross the border into the U.S. again, and that's the corn and potatoes, the tariffs being lifted on those. It's really complex. It's not simple. It's not like there's millions of Mexicans that just want to cross into the U.S. to steal jobs. People do not want to leave their homes to go into hostile climates and hostile territories. Look at the reasons that people are doing it. When you see immigrants, when you see the police pulling people over, I want you to really think about this discussion and think about it on a much deeper level and take back our country to the highest order that it is, not the lowest, but to the highest.
Yeah, and also, when you see people on television, probably is where most people see it in raids, those aren't all necessarily people here illegally, are they?
Well, you can't tell.
Right.
You can only tell by considering the fact that they're brown, which is the only way that you're going to be able to pull people over and ask them for their driver's license now, too.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being here. Lynn Harada, director of Centro Obrero. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is WRIM.com.
expectations too high. No!
To gather round and have a listen?
Well, turn something on. I'm starting to think.
A date which will live in infamy.
Good evening, adults. We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a very special presentation.
Boring. Go back to that infamy guy.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Happy Monday to you. It's me, Al Slayer, back stepping in after Peter and Julian and Night Call, exclusively here on The Riff. I'm here till 5 o'clock, coming up at 5:30 this morning. Mark and Mike will get you ready for Drew and Mike in the morning, right here at 101 WRIF. It is your home of Maui Time 2008 station. And so much more going on as well. We'll take care of you all night long right here. 313-298-WRIF, the phone number here in studio if you want to get a hold of me. Also, for the bashful Slayer at WRIF.com. All right. Lots of stuff coming up this hour. Lots of guys coming to town, including Puddle of Mud, who's a part of our birthday bash coming up on February 15th. Tell you more about that as well. Boba Flex on the way, Pink Floyd, and more. And as I mentioned, your suggestion on the Riff Lines. All right. Let's get it started. It may be Monday morning in the Motor City,
but it's never too late to get lit up. Buck Cherry, Everything That Rocks, 101 WRIF The Riff.
Oh, yeah!